You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Sarah Van Gelder. Sarah Van Gelder is co-founder and executive director of the wonderful Yes magazine. She leads the framing and development of each issue of Yes and writes a column introducing each issue. She blogs at Yes and also at the Huffington Post, writes articles and does interviews for Yes magazine, and speaks on leading-edge innovations that show that another world is not only possible, it is being created, which is also a theme of her new book, which we will be talking about. It is called The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America. Sarah Van Gelder, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for writing this book. In the introduction, you say that you were asking three questions when you headed out on a journey around the United States in a little pickup truck camper. Is anti-racism work best done in communities? Is local activism the best way to stop fossil fuel extraction and transition to sustainability? And can we build a new economy rooted in communities? So is local activism the way to go? What did you expect to find, and what did you find?
Well, I hope to find that people were doing things that I hadn't heard of yet so that I could expand my sense of what possibilities were out there. I took this trip after editing Yes magazine for 20 years, nearly 20 years. So I frankly being somewhat discouraged, because even though I think we have found some really amazing solutions over the course of those 20 years, still some of the things that we care about the most, the things that you listed there, still those continue to be deeply problematic and in some cases are getting worse. So I was looking to see, you know, are there solutions that we haven't found yet? Can we still find reasons to hope that we're going to be able to take on this climate crisis and take on the enormous inequality and poverty that we see in our communities and take on racism? And what I found, I found that people are engaged in doing all of those things. I especially chose to travel to parts of the country that don't normally get covered, that are more on the margins of society, that are feeling in many ways left out of what's happening in the main power centers. And I thought maybe because those areas of the country are not as rewarded for buying into the power structure, maybe they're more free to be more original. Maybe I can find more innovations there. And I did find some great innovations there. I feel like it's still slower than it needs to be, and I think the frustration people are feeling came out in the election of Donald Trump. But I did find, everywhere I went, I found people doing extraordinary work.
Well, and there are a lot of examples in the book. What are some examples you can share of activism you found in particular places that you think might be a model or inspiration for other places around the country or the world?
Well, there were so many, but one of my favorite stories is out of Montana, where a coalition of ranchers and Native Americans and environmentalists were able to stop a giant coal mine from going in southeast Montana. This coal mine would have brought out 1.2 billion tons of coal, shipped it across the state into my state of Washington, and then shipped it overseas to Asia, where people are getting sick from all the coal fumes. So it was a lose-lose proposition all the way from start to finish. Everybody would have been sickened, including our climate, would have been further sickened by this really ill-advised plan. And for years, the ranchers and the native people have been working together to try to stop it. And I went out there and talked to the people who are in the midst of that effort and learned after I returned that their efforts had been successful, that they had, in fact, stopped that giant mine from going in.
And weren't related efforts in your state of Washington State successful just recently since the book came out in stopping, the shipping facility itself?
That's right. There was a giant coal terminal planned for the land of the Lummi tribe north of Seattle. The Lummi tribe was absolutely adamant against allowing that to go through. It would affect their fisheries. It would affect sacred lands. They actually, there's a wonderful image of them on the beach burning a giant check that was coming from the coal company to convince them to go along with this plan. And on it was stamped non-negotiable. And there's a great image of it being on fire as they make clear that they're not going to allow, even though they're a fairly poor tribe, they're not going to trade money for what is priceless, which is their way of life and the fisheries that they depend on. So they were fighting it too. And when I was there in Montana, some of the carvers from the Lummi tribe actually had brought a totem pole as a gift to the people in the Northern Cheyenne tribe. And there was this extraordinary ceremony that included ranchers, included environmentalists and native people. And all of the people who spoke were talking about the sacredness of the land and the water and the responsibility that people who live there today have to pass it along intact to future generations.
So it sounds like something of a broad coalition was built. What did they do to achieve this success?
It was years of work. It was things as mundane as reading long environmental documents and commenting on environmental impact statements and going to Helena, Montana to testify in front of the legislature, going to Washington, D.C. to testify. I didn't track all of that on my road trip. I just arrived during that particular moment to see what was happening in that collaboration that I think was unexpected between these different groups. You know, some of the ranchers, you know, they said, you know, I voted for George W. Bush. I'm a Republican. And, you know, so this was not the ideologically driven debate that we hear so much of in the national scale. This was a group of people who had a deep commitment to the place where they live and that sense of responsibility to pass it along intact to future generations.
It's a familiar story to me because here in Virginia, there's a struggle against a proposed fossil fuel pipeline to be built. And you have people who vote for the worst possible political candidates and advocate the worst possible ideologies that are in favor in general of fossil fuel consumption as much as possible, deny the existence of climate change and so forth. But adamantly oppose putting a pipeline through their own backyards. And I support them in that, of course. But is that enough? And is that more important than getting to better positions nationally, given the huge impact of national policy?
Well, we can talk about what we would like, and we can talk about what's actually happening on the ground. And my aim with my book was to look at what's actually happening on the ground that we can build on. And my sense was that if we take fossil fuel extraction as an issue, one community at a time, we actually have a lot more power than we realize. And once we start doing that community by community, pretty soon our members of Congress and members of the Senate, they start to see that that's where their constituents are at, and we start to be able to build a movement based on that kind of grassroots commitment, which is a really different proposition than I think we've thought we could build power by having some really great nonprofit organizations filled with experts, and we write them a check and we click on the petitions. And I think a lot of us sort of hoped that that would be the way we would get things done, and they would advocate for really smart policies, and the people in Congress would agree with them because they were such great policies. And we've actually not seen a lot of success that way. So I agree that we definitely need national and international policies on climate change for sure. And my question is, where do we actually get the power to get the changes we need? And I found that we've been underestimating how much we can do with the power we have where we live.
Yeah, that's very well said. We are speaking with Sarah Van Gelder, whose book is called The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-Mile Journey Through a New America. I was particularly interested, Sarah, in a couple of stories you had in the book from nearby where I am that I didn't know that much about. One of them I knew somewhat. But you went to Greensboro, and there was a struggle not over, you know, energy policy, but over history. And And in Harrisonburg, Virginia, there was an expansion of restorative justice through the community. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned there?
Sure. So Greensboro, of course, has a long history. It's where one of the original lunch counter sit-ins took place, and I visited the museum that has now been formed out of the old Woolworth building where that sit-in took place. And a more recent part of their history is that there was a demonstration for workers' rights by a leftist group, and I think it was made up mainly of people of color. And a group of neo-Nazis and Klan members, this is 1979, showed up at this demonstration and shot a bunch of people. So six or seven people were killed. I don't remember the exact number. It's in the book. And there were other people injured. And so this was just a horrifying, traumatic event in the life of this community. And what I was looking at when I was there was, what have they done with that since then? How have they processed that really deeply traumatic event? And what they decided to do is to take a page from South Africa and start a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And they partly what they wanted to do is just establish what actually happened on that day, because there had been all these different ideas of, oh, maybe it was a shootout, or maybe it was, you know, maybe it was deserved in some way. And they just felt like, you know, they needed to establish the facts on the ground. So they did a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They took testimony from all sorts of people, eyewitnesses, not with the blessing of the city council. They did it on their own as a community group. They would have loved to have the city's endorsement, but they ended up doing it on their own. And they put out a report that basically laid out the facts on the ground. And, you know, there's still controversy about that. There was controversy when they wanted to do it because a lot of people said, that's too painful, we don't even want to go there again. And after they put out the report, there was still controversy. But one thing that people agreed had been accomplished, which was greater clarity about the truth of what took place. There wasn't some big kumbaya moment, everybody wept and forgave each other. That really didn't happen. There were some apologies. But basically what happened is the community now has a clearer sense of what happened. And in an age of fake news where there's still so much being generated, is just not so. Just knowing what actually happened is an important part of healing. So that was one thing they were doing there. And another thing that I found really inspiring was that the African-American community, after years of being neglected in terms of the economy and in terms of investment, they decided they were going to start their own food cooperative in a neighborhood that has really lacked good access to fresh food. So they just are opening now, I believe, this Renaissance food co-op. And one of the things I loved about it was the instead of calling it a membership, they were all of the people who are involved were called owners. And for a group of people who've been excluded from so much of the American economy, to feel that they were part owners of this wonderful community resource that was going to make them healthy and be a gathering place and bring culturally relevant food into their community. For them to have that opportunity was really a big step for them.
It's inspiring that it's sort of communal journalism. I mean, it's educating the public about facts. And this is something I've liked about Yes Magazine over the years. I think my favorite pieces in Yes Magazine have been collections of public opinion polls informing people with progressive views that they're actually a majority, because you have the media pushing a different story and dismissing people as fringe, and a majority of Americans, I think, on a lot of issues, sharing opinions, but thinking of themselves as a tiny minority when they aren't. It seems very valuable to me. What are your thoughts on that, the importance of people knowing their own numbers?
Yeah, I mean, the downside of that is that we have to rely on polls that are already being taken by someone else. So if they don't think to ask the question, we don't create our own polls, unfortunately.
Well, you can. It costs money, but you know, you can.
So, but we do dig deep at times, dig deep into the polling data and look for things that aren't being well reported, and And a couple of the things that I've found really striking, one is that a majority of Americans have been supporting single-payer health care,
right,
even at a time when none of the political leaders were willing to talk about it, except, you know, more recently Bernie Sanders was. But even before he was bringing that up, a majority of Americans were supporting single-payer health care. So that was one really striking fact that we uncovered. Another is that close to 90% of Americans favor a big investment in renewable energy. So Americans may disagree on the question of climate change, which is very unfortunate because the science is so clear on that. But leaving that aside, whether or not Americans can agree on the science of climate change, they do agree that we should be investing in renewable energy. There's so many good reasons for doing that. And that agreement of almost 90% of Americans cross political lines. Maybe not quite as many Republicans as Democrats want to see that, but a majority do. So
yeah,
there are these great policies out there that our political leaders have yet to really embrace, with some notable exceptions.
Yeah.
And yet Americans are all about those things.
You've had great collections of these facts in your magazine. There's a polling company out of University of Maryland called PIPA that you know sort of informs people of basic information and then asks them questions. So it tells them what the federal budget is and then asks them what they would do with it, because people actually have no idea how much money goes to what. And the result is that majority of Americans want to take huge amounts of money out of the military and put huge amounts of money into useful things like environmental protection. And, you know, which brings me to sort of my central concern about the shortcomings of local activism or not in my backyard activism, despite its enormous strengths. That is that the U.S. government is primarily a war-making, weapons-dealing machine. And from the point of view of communities in the United States, that's seen as jobs, even though that's false, even though you'd have more jobs and a better economy spending the money in any other way or even not taxing it in the first place. It's perceived as jobs, and the destruction is largely elsewhere. How do we build from local activism dealing with local issues to some sort of movement that can reduce the risk of nuclear apocalypse?
Yeah, I think it's an important question, and the work that's happening locally can do so much in its own local community, but then people ultimately have to join forces to get some bigger things done. And that's one of the lessons, I think, of Standing Rock, is Standing Rock began as a local, very local effort.
Yeah.
And with a group of young people who said, you know, we're just not going to see this happen in our community. And then they brought in, or they called for support, and tribes from all over the country came and all over the world. And then a lot of non-tribal folks came. And so it built. And it built into something that is now helping pipeline efforts, people who are trying to block pipeline efforts, it's now building a movement that's also helping other people who are trying to block pipelines in their own communities. And that's challenging the fossil fuel model, which is to continue to build this fossil fuel infrastructure at a time when we need to be doing the opposite, taking that infrastructure apart and switching to renewables. So movements do often start locally and build globally. So I think on the question of peace and war, part of the question is how do you understand that question from the perspective of people in their local communities? And one way to understand it is through what you just mentioned, the tax system. How much of our money is going to support that military-industrial complex? How many Americans want to be helping to support arms sales to Saudi Arabia? You know, if the word gets out, how many Americans would really want to support that? They were very clever, the Congress, in terms of distributing the largesse from the military-industrial complex around different congressional districts to keep that kind of a political support happening. And that's really tough to take apart. But I want to also just suggest one answer that goes one level deeper, which is that our culture now is built on the notion that, happiness comes from how much we consume. And in order to consume a lot of stuff, we have to get that stuff from somewhere. And for years, that somewhere, a lot of it has been from other countries, whether that's low cost for their natural resources or low cost for their labor. And they have not been benefiting, in many cases, from that appropriation, that extraction of their wealth for our consumerism. So one of the things that I was looking for as I was traveling for this book was, is there a different kind of value system emerging in communities? When people spend time with each other and start looking at what's really valuable in life, time with friends and family and drinking water and clean air and a good education system, when they start looking at those things, I think they get less attached to the notion that it's all about consumerism. It's all about me first.
Yeah.
And our military system has been to enforce American access to the resources of the world. And if we can stop needing those resources so much, if we can start being more self-reliant, we can also quit using the military to enforce our access to other people's resources.
Yes, indeed. I sometimes think of militarism as the neglected evil of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s three evils, but really materialism is the one that almost nobody wants to take on, and we do have to address them together, and together with racism. One of the things that struck me in reading the different types of activism in the book was the seeming importance of local banking and credit unions and the need to deal with where people are putting their money, because, you know, we have people fighting pipelines whose retirement savings are invested in pipeline companies, and we have teachers, you know, whose public retirement pension funds are invested in weapons dealers. So, you know, lots of future wars need to guarantee their retirement security. How important do you think it is to get control of where our savings and our money is flowing to?
Oh, I think it's huge. I think the whole campus effort to get campus endowments out of fossil fuels has been a really, really important and big effort. And now the defund DAPL, last I saw online, the number was $50 million has been.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, divested from the banks that are funding DAPL, which is basically almost all the big banks, indirectly or directly. So while people are doing that, they're also asking, well, where should I put my money instead? And their local credit union is a great option. Those are organizations that are investing back in the communities and keeping, for the most part, keeping the money out of the big Wall Street casino, you know, bet on whatever can make profits regardless of the damage kind of system. So that's great. But what we need even beyond that is we need more ways to invest in things that we really want to build, invest in our local communities, invest in worker co-ops, invest in renewables. And those systems still really aren't very robust. There's a few of those, but I think that's where, you know, I was one of the main things I was looking at as I was traveling was, where is the local economy being rebuilt, and what's working, what's getting in the way? And there are some really important examples of things that are working, and the funding is still a huge question. So the more that we can start rechanneling money out of those really destructive corporations and Wall Street banks and start reinvesting it in the things that we want, I think the faster this whole movement can take off.
Yeah, and there are great examples in your book, Sarah Van Gilder. We have just a few minutes left. Can you just describe briefly this program of restorative justice that seems to be spreading in Harrisonburg, Virginia, of all places?
Yeah, Harrisonburg, Virginia is the location of the Eastern Mennonite University, which is one of the hub of the restorative justice movement. So the idea of restorative justice is that instead of thinking of every problem or conflict as a crime as something that deserves harsh punishment, you think of it as a time when you need reconciliation. You need to make reparations for things that were done wrong. but then you also ultimately want to rebuild the community and rebuild the relationships. And this is especially important with young people because so many young people get into trouble. And if you start right away with harsh policies in schools and people getting expelled and so forth, you're basically setting young people on a track to wind up in juvenile detention and eventually prison. So it's really important to have this other set of tools to reconcile a student with their teacher or with their classmates or whatever the issue was. So this is taking off in a big way. And I went to Harrisonburg because I wanted to see what they were doing locally and found out that the police department actually is starting to get on board. They've started to realize, as police departments around the country are getting confronted by Black Lives Matter and by the public that's really angry at how the police have been treating, especially people of color, they're starting to realize that their legitimacy requires them to have a different kind of relationship with their community. And that means, as a starting point, to talk to people with respect when they stop them on the street. And that is part of the notion of restorative justice, is simply to be respectful. And the second part of that is to say, you know, if a situation comes along that doesn't have to be treated as a crime, doesn't have to be treated through the court system, is there another alternative? And so they're bringing together a community of people who can work with somebody, for example, who embezzles some money from their employer. Can they work with them on repaying what was stolen, but also getting them back on a better track so that they don't just have prison as an option? So it was very interesting to me to hear the police officer who I interviewed really talk about what that means to him and why he believes that's an essential tool for a police department to have nowadays.
And so if people want to try to get this going in their community, they can read your book, obviously, contact Eastern Mennonite University. What else should they pursue?
Well, another great organization that I recommend is the RJOI, which is Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth, which is started by Fania Davis and has been doing some amazing work in the school system on turning situations that could result in really harsh punishments into situations where young people could get the guidance they need to succeed.
Very good advice. Lots more of it in the book. The book is called The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America. Might inspire you to take your own journey of that sort if you can manage it. Sarah Van Gelder is the author. She's also the co-founder and executive director at Yes Magazine, which you should check out online or in hard copy. Sarah Van Gelder, thank you for taking the trip, writing the book, and coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. And here's a new one. Sign a petition to urge Congress to open an investigation into the impeachment of President Donald Trump at impeachdonaldtrumpnow.org. And go to davidswanson.org for answers to all the usual isn't Mike Pence worse, what about the evil Russians, and so on and so forth questions that will arise. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a travel ban aimed at Muslims, a wall on the Mexican border, an attempt to outlaw sanctuary cities. Every day of the Trump administration brings new reason to protest. But the mass arrest of hundreds of people protesting the inauguration, including legal observers and journalists, reminds us that the right to speak up still needs protection. We'll hear from activist and attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Also on the program, in February 2014, tens of thousands of protesters marched through the streets of Washington, D.C. to protest the Keystone XL project, the biggest climate march in U.S. history. Last year, the Standing Rock Sioux and other water protectors galvanized the world's attention with their resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Now we're told both those projects are back on the table. But that doesn't mean they'll happen, so says David Turnbull, campaigns director of Oil Change International. We'll hear from him about that. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. The day after the historic Women's March, the New York Times ran a story with a premise out of a 50s sitcom about how the men of Montclair, New Jersey, coped with housework and kids while all the womenfolk were away carrying signs. The editor responsible didn't even disagree with the social media drubbing the piece got, telling Huffington Post, "It was a bad idea from the get-go. We blew it." That wasn't the Times' response when the paper was criticized for misrepresenting the lives, not of upper-middle-class couples in Montclair, but of food stamp recipients. That January 13th story's headline captured the tone, "In the shopping cart of a food stamp household, lots of soda," along with a photograph of a shopping cart filled with almost nothing but Coca-Cola and orange soda. The piece, based on a USDA report, claimed that food stamp recipients spent about 10% of their food budget on soft drinks. While the biggest single food budget item for non-food stamp households, readers were told, is milk. The piece struck a number of folks as suspicious. One of them, University of Minnesota professor Joe Sass, wrote a response for Jacobin, noting that the USDA report found that those non-food stamp families spent 4.03% of their food budget on milk and 4.01% on soft drinks. That's the basis on which the Times distinguishes what Sass calls the bad soda people from the normal milk people. In fact, the main point of the USDA report was that, quote, there were no major differences in the expenditure patterns of SNAP and non-SNAP households, no matter how the data were categorized, close quote, SNAP being the acronym for food stamps. So that's right. The Times story about how much junk food the poor ate was based on a study that found that the poor eat about as much junk food as anybody else. The Times did correct the claim that food stamp recipients spend 10% of their budget on soda. The actual figure was 5%. And Times public editor Liz Spade concluded that the article didn't do much to advance the discussion. But the editor in charge, Tara Parker Pope, stood by the piece, claiming that the fact that non-SNAP families ate as much junk food as SNAP families was a central theme in the story. Again, that would be the story headlined, "In the shopping cart of a food stamp household, lots of soda." Telling tales about poor people, it seems, means never having to say you're sorry. Washington Post fact-checker Glenn Kessler addressed Bernie Sanders' claim that 36,000 people will die yearly if Obamacare is repealed. Now, this is the same Washington Post that once ran 16 negative stories on Sanders in the space of 16 hours and managed to squeeze four separate Sanders-bashing articles out of one dubious study. Here, Kessler gives four Pinocchios, the highest score reserved for Whoppers, to Sanders' warning that, as Republicans try to appeal the Affordable Care Act, they should be reminded every day that 36,000 people will die yearly as a result. Sanders' number came from Think Progress, which in turn derived its forecast from an Urban Institute report and its estimate of the effect of insurance on mortality from an Annals of Internal Medicine study. But, Kessler says, Sanders didn't include all of the qualifiers from the original study in his tweet. And his warning was based on what Kessler calls the pretty big assumption that the ACA will not be replaced with some new Republican program, the barest outlines of which have yet to be described. But what tips this claim into four Pinocchio territory, he says, was the fact that Sanders expressed a prediction in the future tense. He said that people will die rather than could die. Well, fortunately, an antidote to this nonsense appeared in the Washington Post itself in an op-ed from Steffi Woolhandler and David Himmelstein. Teaching doctors who have studied how death rates are affected by changes in health care coverage for more than 30 years. They cite the biggest and most definitive study of what happens to death rates when Medicaid coverage is expanded. It found that for every 455 people who gained coverage across several states, one life was saved per year. Applying that figure to even a conservative estimate of 20 million losing coverage in the event of an ACA repeal, they note, yields an estimate of 43,956 deaths annually. Kessler's chiding of Sanders, they note, presumes that Republicans will replace the ACA with reforms that preserve coverage. But, quote, while repeal seems highly likely, indeed it's already underway using a legislative vehicle that requires only 50 Senate votes, replacement, which would require 60 votes, is much less certain, close quote. And finally, both the Washington Post and the New York Times had pieces about declining support for the left in France and the rise of a nationalist right in both Italy and France. Both pieces attributed the rise in support for the right to people losing from globalization, implying that this is some impersonal process causing people to be losers. As Dean Baker noted on FAIR.org, people are suffering because of the insistence of the European Union that its members pursue austerity policies. These policies have led to almost a full decade of near zero per capita GDP growth in France and a drop of more than 10% in per capita GDP in Italy. There's nothing inevitable about the policies. They're conscious choices of the political leaders in Europe. Baker calls it incredible that both papers neglected to mention the role of austerity in hurting workers. It would make the disgust with elites much more understandable. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. A spontaneously organized rally in opposition to Trump's proposed travel ban for people from Muslim-majority countries packed Washington Square Park here in New York January 25th. Just days after millions took part in women's marches around the country, those coming the day after thousands demonstrated at Trump's inauguration. As this administration proceeds, more and more people are feeling driven to show resistance in some visible way, including taking part in street protests, which makes the treatment of protesters by law enforcement and the courts, always critical, a front burner concern. What should we learn then from the mass arrest of protesters and journalists at the inauguration and the decision to bring felony riot charges against them? Mara Verheyden-Hilliard is an activist and attorney. She's co-founder and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Mara Verheyden-Hilliard.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the January 20th arrests were sort of a footnote in much media coverage of the inauguration. I wonder, can you fill us in on what went on there and what concerns you about those arrests?
Well, the January 20th protests against Trump's inauguration were very significant, and the media coverage itself was very interesting because there was two significant demonstrations that were occurring. And the media only, of course, wanted to cover the demonstration where there were windows broken and other property damage. But there was also a mass demonstration directly along the parade route at the Navy Memorial where there were tens of thousands of people both there and stuck outside of checkpoints trying to get in to be up against the parade route. And it was a very significant, very large demonstration that greeted Donald Trump in his first appearance as president coming down along the Pennsylvania Avenue parade route. Now, there was also at the same time demonstrations occurring away from the parade route, and also people who couldn't get in through the checkpoints began marching to try and peacefully demonstrate because they couldn't even get in. Side. Mm-hmm. So those demonstrations ended up with mass arrests and collective punishment, use of pepper spray and other less lethal munitions. And we're very concerned and currently performing an investigation at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund into unconstitutional and illegal actions of the district's Metropolitan Police Department. We brought litigation, a series of lawsuits over a period of about 15 years, including two major class actions representing more than 1,000 people who had been falsely arrested. The district ended up having to pay out more than $25 million in damages to protesters who had been brutalized, who had been falsely arrested, who had been tied up in stress and duress positions after false arrests for some 24 hours or more. And significantly, there were major changes in the law of policing of the District of Columbia. Those changes came under what's called the First Amendment Rights and Police Standards Act. And when one goes through those requirements, it would appear that the interim chief of police, Peter Newsom, is in violation, in stark violation, of not just of the obvious obligations under the Constitution, but these very clearly delineated requirements on policing.
Well, and some of those had to do with whether police needed to make a call for folks to disperse before they started arresting people and that sort of thing. But what I'm also thinking about is the sweeping up, which you sort of touched on, and that's why D.C. had to pay out that money after 2002. And it seems like it happened again, where there are folks who are breaking the law, you know, by breaking a window or something, and then the folks just kind of near them are being arrested and are being charged with felony riot? Does that seem to be, it seems like it's almost proximity that people are being charged
with? That's in fact correct, and that's what appears to be what's happening here. Now, the police, by the Constitution and by the particularities that were detailed in these laws that we had sought as equitable relief from these class action lawsuits, when the police are dealing with a crowd of people engaged in First Amendment activity, if there is some section of that crowd that they are observing are committing acts of violence or property destruction, or if the police are asserting that the crowd is what's called substantially infected with violence, there are circumstances under which they can act against the group as a group. But it's limited in terms of what they can do. They could use police lines to temporarily control a group if they are asserting that within that group are people that they've identified as having committed criminal acts, and then they're dealing with those individuals. It does not mean that when the police have criminal actions occurring, like property destruction or damage, that then they can turn to everyone else in proximity. And based on association, which is truly First Amendment political association, arrest everybody else. And that appears to be what they've done. And also they were using chemical munitions against just huge swaths of people. There is a requirement for particularized probable cause. If you are going to deprive somebody of their liberty as a police officer, you have to have particularized probable cause that that person has committed a crime. It is not a crime to be in proximity to other people who break the law in conjunction with First Amendment activities. It is not a crime to be reporting on protests that are going on, even if portions of those protests become violent. And that seems to be what Peter Newsom has done here. And I note that we sued him in his individual capacity after the mass arrests in Pershing Park in 2002. And the D.C. Circuit denied him qualified immunity, citing his basis for the mass arrests as ludicrous. And it would appear that he has not learned the lessons of 2002.
Right. And here he is. He's now acting D.C. police chief, but possibly D.C. police chief, we can see that he's going to be facing very likely many more protests and demonstrations on his watch, which makes this an important case to follow.
And also they are clearly overcharging people. They are engaging in trumped up charges with these felony charges against people in proximity as well as journalists. One suspects that that is occurring, one, to force people to plead to lesser charges in the hopes that then they can avoid the mass civil litigation that would ultimately result from this kind of false mass arrest, and also because it would appear they're trying to escape certain requirements and responsibilities that they have under the law when they arrest people for misdemeanors in the context of First Amendment activity.
I see. Well, I understand the desire to distinguish between law-abiding protesters and those who vandalize, for example, but we see a lot of shorthand references to violent versus nonviolent protests. It seems worth saying that breaking a Starbucks window is different than hitting someone on the head with a brick or a baton, for that matter. In this case, though, the D.C. police are almost acknowledging, aren't they, that the people that they identified as having broken the law, they didn't catch.
Right. In their charging papers, they are acknowledging that the people that broke the law, that formed the basis for their actions against the larger group, are not the people that they then have arrested in the larger group. They, even in some of the charging papers, appear to be holding people who were arrested responsible for actions that occurred after they were in custody, which I don't believe people have the time travel capacity to be doing this. And it really shows the indiscriminate nature of the police arrest. And there was a lot of violence that was occurring from the police, and the police need to be held responsible for that violence, the use of the batons, the use of chemical munitions against people. And in the context of First Amendment protest, and as we enter this coming period, it is absolutely critical that there, in fact, be particularity, that there be a distinguishing when the police are taking action against any group of people. They cannot take actions against groups of demonstrators because they are demonstrators. They are only within their authority to take actions against someone that has violated the law. And I think here you have this very evident effort of the police to really roll back the significant achievements that have been made in the District of Columbia, and they're doing it now in the age of Trump. They clearly feel that they have leeway to do so, and that's why we're seeking to hold them accountable. We're opening an investigation into this conduct, and we're hearing from a lot of people as to what happened and intend to take the next appropriate steps.
Well, let me just ask you finally, I know even before the inauguration, you had to fight to be able to use public spaces for demonstrations, you know, and we're also hearing, you know, people talking about maybe there could be a ban on public protest. I feel there are a lot of mixed messages people are getting about whether civil disobedience is permitted or not. I mean, maybe it's just worth underscoring what we can do and what some would say we should be doing.
People have the right to take to the streets, to express themselves, to resist when they feel that they're faced with a government and with politicians and with policies that are rolling back their civil rights and their civil liberties. And that is, in fact, the only way that we've ever moved forward with progressive change in our society. There is clearly an effort by government authorities to try and stifle and push back and stonewall the ability of people to do that. The fact that we had to fight so hard for permitted demonstrations, for lawful permitted demonstrations, I think is extremely defining of the hostility towards First Amendment activities. Now, the First Amendment obviously protects lawful, peaceable assembly. If people choose to risk arrest with civil disobedience, they also obviously may do so. But the fact is, the police cannot arrest other people for sharing similar political views of people who may break the law. And they can't act against a group as a group. They have an obligation to act with particularity.
We've been speaking with Mara Verheyden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Find them online at justiceonline.org. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
It was a pleasure to be with you.
With one swipe of the presidential pen, the Dakota Access and Keystone pipelines were back on the agenda, so reported CNN. But back on the agenda is not the same thing as being a done deal. Our next guest says those pipelines will not be completed. David Turnbull is campaigns director at Oil Change International. He joins us now by phone from Oakland. Welcome to Counterspin, David Turnbull.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, a lot of news reports say it's unclear exactly what the executive orders on DAPL and on Keystone, what they mandate. Do you have any more clarity on what actually changed or changes with that swipe of the presidential pen?
You know, it's still a little unclear. Mm-hmm. It's not totally clear. What the president has signed is incredibly legally astute, which is not a huge surprise. But what he has signed with respect to the Dakota Access Pipeline and Keystone XL are two separate memorandums. For Dakota Access, it instructs the Army Corps of Engineers to go ahead and issue the remaining permits that are required to finish construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Of course, we know that there are major issues with that pipeline, from environmental to social resistance issues to consultation with Native tribes. And so our view is that while that instruction is in place, there's still some steps that need to be taken by the Army Corps of Engineers to actually consider the pipeline with the robust review process that's necessary. On Keystone, there is no application from the Keystone Builders TransCanada that is on the books right now. What Donald Trump has done is said, we hope that TransCanada will reapply for the Keystone XL permit. And when they do, I'm instructing the State Department to run a swift review process within 60 days to essentially ram that pipeline through. We also know that for Keystone XL, there is massive opposition to that pipeline, just as with Dakota Access, that was built over years of movement building and campaigning. And furthermore, there is no actual approved route through the state of Nebraska, which is a requirement for it being built as well. So these executive orders or memorandums that the president has signed are important in that they are reviving pipelines that had been defeated, but it's not a done deal by any means.
Before we talk about resistance, I'd like to get your reaction to, it's a quote from a New York Times article, but I have seen it elsewhere. It says, quote, the pipelines were more about symbol than substance, but generated enormous passion on both sides of the debate, close quote. What do you make of that take that Keystone and Dakota Access are really not substantive issues, that it's really more about people's feelings?
Well, I think you can ask any one of the many thousands of water protectors, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe members in the Dakotas, about whether it's just a symbol to them. It absolutely isn't. It's impacting their culture, their land, their water. It's a pipeline that would incentivize massive increases in oil production in the Bakken oil fields in the Dakotas, which run entirely counter to our efforts to combat climate change. So while people may brush it off as a symbolic pipeline or a symbolic protest, to the folks that are on the ground risking their lives in some cases, resisting and working to protect the water, that's simply just not the case. On Keystone XL, it would incentivize increased production of the dirtiest oil on the planet. We have done numerous analyses that show that that increased production of the tar sands in Canada would totally hamper and essentially make our efforts to address climate change nearly impossible. So again, you can ask the people that are along the route in Nebraska whether this is a symbolic fight for them, or you can ask scientists whether increasing production of the tar sands is aligned with our efforts to address climate change. And both of those groupings will tell you that it's not merely symbolic.
Well, the vision we have is that we have an industry, a fossil fuel industry, that does this thing that is recognized as harmful, but they do it because it's profitable. And then on the other side in this vision, we have government, which tries to check that harmful behavior, but maybe not very effectually. Oil Change International has just recently called attention to how that really isn't the vision of how things work. Can you tell us a little bit about the subsidies involved here?
Sure. The U.S. government gives tens of billions of dollars a year to the fossil fuel industry by way of subsidies, tax breaks, handouts from the American people to an industry that has been in existence for over 100 years and is doing the work to destroy our planet. These are subsidies that are totally inappropriate, both from an economic standpoint, but also from a moral standpoint. We should not be subsidizing an industry that is hurting our communities, that is impairing our climate, and that is raking in record profits. Massive profits. We have been pushing for an end to fossil fuel subsidies, not just in the United States, but around the globe for years now, especially since in 2009, the G20 nations decided to commit to eliminating these subsidies, and yet they continue to this day.
I think it just interferes so strongly with the picture of government as, you know, trying to check the exploitative behavior of these companies, but just maybe not doing it quite so well. It's in fact, there's something entirely different than that going on, it seems like. Well, now we've got Scott Pruitt at EPA. We've got Rex Tillerson at State. I don't have a question connected with that, except to bring you back to your confidence that these pipelines are not going to go through, which I think many people would say, well, golly, all the odds are assembled on the other side of that equation. So why are you so confident in the resistance to this?
When Keystone XL was first thrust into the national conversation, every single pundit, every single expert in the industry, all of the odds were saying that Keystone XL was going to sail through and be approved, and that our resistance and protests were going to be just a side note to a pretty quick process. We know that was not the case. We got Keystone XL rejected because there was a massive movement that was pestering and protesting the administration at every single turn. The Dakota Access Pipeline was also fully on its way to being built, and amazing Standing Rock Sioux Tribe members and other water protectors stood up and said no, despite major odds. And we could not see what the resolution was going to be when that Standing Rock camp was first established, but they had all sorts of intention and inspiration and drive to protect their land and water. And at the end of the day in the Obama administration, it was stopped. So we have beaten large odds before, and I have every confidence that those movements are going to beat these large odds again.
We've been speaking with David Turnbull of Oil Change International. You can find their work online at priceofoil.org. David Turnbull, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
In a world where unreality is taking over, there is still a floodlight to find the facts. It's called science. But that's not easy to understand, and there's more and more of it. We need translators. We need scouts to call out from ahead. Robert Marston Fanny is one of those voices. In my opinion, he has two great skills that help him. Robert was a threat analyst for the world's premier information group called JANES. He knows how to dig and research. But above that, Robert Marston Fanny is also an author of a popular science fiction series called Luthiel's Song. And taking those skills to analyze danger and his creative writing, Robert Marston Fanny has produced one of the world's top hubs for disseminating climate science. It's called Robert Scribbler's Blog, and it's kind of a community now, really. Robert Marston Fanny, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It really is an honor to be here, and thank you for that very kind introduction. It's great to be back.
Well, it's been a while. Unbelievably, it's pretty well 3 years later, and people are still downloading our last conversation at a rate of about 200 shows a month. And that seems like ages ago. So much has happened, and climate news continues to pour in at a mad rate. It is hard to keep up, isn't it?
It is overwhelming. When I started in 2012, the pace was somewhat manageable in the sense that I could look at a set of topics that I thought were important in that given time and be able to mostly highlight them all. And now I think anyone that is covering climate science is trying to play catch up. It's feeling like they're running to stand still just because there is so much information right now. There's so much that is happening that appears to be critical and probably is. And in all honesty, I think if the New York Times had devoted all of its staff to trying to cover climate change, they would still not be able to hit everything that needs to be hit. It really has gotten to that point.
Well, we need to get to Carlos Slim or Jeff Bezos and say, that's what we need. We need a huge national staff and all the resources just to get this catastrophe on the front pages and the back pages.
Well, threat awareness is very important. It's funny, a fellow blogger of mine, Nevin, who covers sea ice primarily, recently went on sabbatical, and so it's an overwhelming issue. But one of the things that he mentioned to me was that not only is it psychologically difficult, it's just such a huge problem, and it's so important to everyone. But one of the things I said to him, he was depressed. He was saying that, well, all I'm doing is focusing on problems. And I said, well, the first part of dealing with a problem is coming to grips with it, is trying to understand it. And if you don't understand it, then you really can't develop an effective response. And I think that many of us are really still trying to get a good picture of the threat. There are many different opinions, I think, about the threat of climate change. There are many very informed opinions, but I still think as a civilization, this is an out-of-context problem. This is not something that we're used to dealing with. And so identifying that threat is part of the process of response. It's the first step.
Well, okay, let's get specific here, Robert. And this is something that Nevin actually came back from his sabbatical just to write a piece about. And it's one of the biggest stories in the world, I think, but it's not that big on Twitter or Instagram. And it's just this: the total amount of sea ice on the planet is falling. And that seems pretty darn important. But in a recent interview on Radio EcoShock, our Canadian climate scientist guest, Paul Beckwith, complained that the scientists in his community just didn't seem interested in that fact. And I suppose for a while it seemed like the ice loss in the Arctic was being countered by growing sea ice in the Antarctic. But this year, they both crashed. And the fact is, we're melting the ice right off the planet. So Robert Scribler's blog captured the big picture, I think, on January 13th with this blog title, "The World Has Never Experienced a Time When Global Sea Ice Was So Weak and Reduced." Robert, are there enough exclamation marks to capture this huge moment?
I don't think so. In all honesty, at a certain point, superlatives become dull, because when it comes to climate science, everything appears to be superlative to me at this time. And global sea ice coverage in 2016 was one of the huge exclamation marks. We had the hottest year on record. It looks like, according to GISS, it looks like we are going to hit about 1.2 degrees Celsius above average in the atmosphere for 2016. And both the Arctic and Antarctic experienced above normal temperatures, significant above normal temperatures. The Arctic in particular, during the fall and spring and winter of 2016, the summer was relatively average, but the other three seasons were ridiculously warm. And in the fall especially, we had days when the entire Arctic region, and that's the entire region above the 66 degree north latitude line, so you're talking about an enormous area, that it was hitting about 11 degrees Celsius above average in that entire region on certain days. And there was a month, October, in which the averages for the entire region for the month were in the range of 5 to 6 degrees Celsius above average. And I know these are just numbers, but it's ludicrous. You never see areas of the world of such an extent, such an expanse, such a large expanse of the world hit temperatures that are that far above average for such a long period of time. You just don't ever see it, but we saw it in 2016, and it's quite frankly, to me, it's pretty terrifying. If there are scientists, as you said, that Paul Beckwith said that there were scientists that weren't concerned about sea ice, in all honesty, I can't imagine why they would not be concerned about sea ice if that was the case. Sea ice is a critical aspect of the climate system. It serves as a deflector shield for incoming solar radiation. It cools the Earth. It covers an enormous area. It houses numerous ecosystems and is basically the home for some of the most vital life support systems on the planet. The polar regions of the world are the most productive, meaning that they are, especially in the oceans, they are in many ways the source of the vitality of life on Earth. And so if you start to lose sea ice, you lose a critical feature of the climate system and you lose a critical defense against short-term, medium-term, and long-term warming. And so if you understand climate and you understand how the climate system works and you understand ecosystems and you understand how life on Earth works, then sea ice is very important. It's something that we need to maintain a stable climate. And if we lose that, then we really don't have a stable climate anymore.
Well, I followed a link from your blog to the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center. I think they're in Colorado, and they put out a report on January the 1st about the low sea ice extent continuing at both poles. Do we know from them how much sea ice we've lost? I mean, I looked at their graphs, and you can see all the past years as certain colored lines slowly getting lower. And then this year, it's like a garish red line that just, boom, drops off the bottom of the graph.
So I want to be pretty clear about NSIDC. I think that NSIDC, based on that report, it seemed to me that they were very concerned. Maybe I'm wrong. I haven't spoken to any of the scientists there, but this is the most alarming report I've ever seen from them. And scientists generally tend to moderate and try and speak in a moderate way. Scientists tend to try to not alarm people. So when you're dealing with alarming data and you're a scientist, you're kind of walking a razor thin line. But with regards to the amount of sea ice that has been lost globally in the latter portion of 2016, during December, global sea ice extent, according to NSIDC, hit a negative 4.4 million square kilometers. And that's like losing two Greenlands worth of sea ice. And global sea ice extent, according to the NSIDC measure, has never dropped so low, ever. That's a 8 sigma standard deviation outside the norm for the average range from 1980 to 2010. 8 sigma, when you talk about standard deviations, if you go beyond 2 standard deviations, you're talking about a rare event. An 8 sigma event is something like 1 in many billions probability of occurring under normal variant circumstances. Of course, as we know, the world is warming. So for the Arctic, there's something, and the Antarctic, that there's something that is removing sea ice. And we know that that is global temperature. And so it's ocean temperature anomalies in a very high positive range, and it's global atmospheric temperature anomalies. And in the polar region, there's a process called polar amplification, which tends to preferentially warm the poles, particularly the Arctic. But it appears that in 2016, the Antarctic experienced a decent amount of polar amplification as well. So with regards, though, to how much ice has been lost over an extended period of time, it's extraordinary. We've never experienced that much global sea ice loss in the monitor in any season, in any period. During 2012, we saw very severe sea ice losses in the Arctic, but this is a global event, and both poles were involved.
Robert, I'm going to cut in here and play 2 minutes from Dr. Jennifer Francis from Rutgers. This was just posted on YouTube January 16th by John Cook. It's about a new Arctic feedback.
2016 has been a bizarre year right from the get-go. We're seeing a new feedback develop between the Arctic being so warm and its effect on the jet stream and vice versa. The very warm Arctic in the early fall is causing the jet stream to take a wavier path. This is something that we've been studying for a while. And those bigger swings in the jet stream are transporting more heat and moisture up into the Arctic. The heat is obvious, that melts more ice, but that moisture is a big part of the story. And we're seeing in 2016 an all-time record high amount of water vapor in the atmosphere in the Arctic. Now that water vapor is important because it's a greenhouse gas, so it contributes to the already warming effects of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, but it's also it causes more clouds to form, and those clouds are also very good at trapping the heat down by the surface. So we've got all this extra water vapor in the atmosphere that has been transported from the south by this wavy jet stream, but also because there's more evaporation in the open water areas where there used to be sea ice. So there's kind of a double whammy there in terms of that really important water vapor. So then the feedback part of the story is that because the Arctic has been staying so warm this fall, I mean, crazy warm, 20 degrees centigrade on some days warmer than average, that is feeding back then to the jet stream and causing it to continue to be very wavy, which continues to pump more heat and moisture up there. So we're seeing this new feedback mechanism kicking in that I think is playing a big role in this fall being so ridiculously warm.
That was Dr. Jennifer Francis on the new Arctic feedback. Let's move on now with our guest, Robert Marston Fanny from Robert Scribler's blog. We know the White House is filling up with worst kinds of climate deniers. The people who promise to reduce or destroy every branch of government have been given power over them. We won't talk about the billionaire Secretary of Education who hates the public school system, or the billionaire labor secretary who hates organized labor. But we do have to talk about the people who swore to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency and the Paris Climate Accord, and now the fossil fuel kings promise to make America into a great oil exporter again, damn the climate, full speed into the apocalypse. Robert Marston Fanny, what do you think the new captains of the American government could or will do?
Well, if they operate in the manner that they promise, they will set us back at least a decade when it comes to climate responses. Unless, if states and Congress and, say, for example, progressives or people who are concerned about climate change in Congress, there could be some Republicans. I don't see many, but I guess one could hope. If there is a stiff resistance, we could nearly just stand still on climate policy in the U.S. for 4 years and basically just resist Trump. And honestly, that would be the best case scenario, is to simply stand still. It's possible that states on their own and cities on their own could produce positive climate policies. But if you're fighting the federal government, there will be certainly a give and take. So I think that the net would be about zero when it comes to policy, even if everything on every other scale was amazingly positive. If you have a president that is against climate action, that fights it, that goes after scientists, that goes after the Paris Climate Summit, that harasses other world leaders who are interested in confronting climate change, who shames people for talking about climate change, who puts a person like Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who has been involved in spreading climate change denial through ExxonMobil's media support and public relations activities. for, you know, as long as he's been an executive there. So what we're dealing with is, as president, as the cabinet, people who have been fighting to delay climate action for most of their adult lives, and who in their public communications have misinformed the public about climate change, have downplayed the issue of climate change, and have, by that communication, sought to continuously sandbag any efforts to promote solutions to climate change and to make people aware. That's a worst-case scenario for the U.S. and for the world, because America matters. America's global leadership matters. When Obama was president, don't get me wrong, Obama wasn't perfect as a climate leader, but Obama did produce a good deal of progress when it came to climate change, numerous policies that were beneficial in a net sense, and renewable energy efficiency, reducing consumption, harmful consumption, all occurred while Obama was president. And he promoted people who were leaders in the climate movement into his cabinet. What you have here with Trump is the opposite. You have people who have attacked scientists. You have people who actively lie about climate change to the public. And Trump is one of those. I mean, that's the exact opposite of leadership. It's anti-leadership.
I want to get to another point, and that is that most of humanity does live in the Northern Hemisphere. That's where most of the land is. And, of course, it bothers my Australian and New Zealand listeners and people in South Africa to no end that we talk about us so loudly on the social media. And right now for us, it's winter, and it's easy for us to forget about the heat that will drive millions of other people from their homes. And, of course, that's when I admired that while we're fixated on winter, you and your blog warned about new uninhabitable zones from heat, not just in North Africa, but in the very countries who earn their huge riches by exporting fossil fuels like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And it's going to ruin their home climate. Tell us about that blog posted in December about the great heat.
So the Max Planck Institute this year and last year has been producing excellent research about habitability in certain regions of the world just simply based on increase in temperature. Recently, there's been a number of media reports based on that research. I happened to pitch in because I thought it was an important issue. Now, what we're dealing with as the world warms is a region of the world near the equator that will ultimately become uninhabitable. Now, when we talk about uninhabitable, we talk about uninhabitable if you venture outside. It doesn't mean that there wouldn't be areas where climate was completely controlled indoors where people could survive. It's just that outdoor activity would be severely limited, as if you were living in a large region of the world that had temperatures similar to Death Valley type conditions. And what you're talking about is not just a small area. You're talking about a large band of Africa that includes the near Sahara region, much of the Sahel region, such as Sudan. You're talking about Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, parts of Turkey. You're talking about Israel. Southern Israel, the Sinai Peninsula. And that's really kind of ground zero for where the uninhabitability band starts. It kind of starts in that region and then it expands. And what Max Planck is talking about, currently we have about that region experiences about 11 to 20 days every year presently where temperatures are above 40 degrees Celsius every year. Right. And we think of this region of the world as very hot. So on average, about 11 to 20 days, it's above 40 degrees Celsius. That's 104 degrees Fahrenheit for people who are Fahrenheit oriented. By mid-century, that period of time is expected to, according to Max Planck, extend to 80 days. So you're basically taking this extremely warm region of the world and you're multiplying the number of very hot days by about 4 to 8. And some of the maximum temperatures in that region are expected to reach, you know, well above 46 or 50 degrees Celsius on many days. 50 degrees Celsius is 122 degrees Fahrenheit. And the average for that region is expected to increase by 2.5 to 6 degrees Celsius by mid-century. And this is under middle-term fossil fuel emissions. It's not pure business as usual, which would advance that time frame a bit. So what you're talking about is a region of the world where it just becomes less and less possible to operate outdoors. And it's not just an issue of crops. Crops in those kinds of situations simply become non-viable for many places. You can't grow things right now in Saudi Arabia outdoors unless you're constantly watering things. So imagine a Saudi Arabia-type environment extending over a good chunk of northern Africa and expanding southward as the Sahel region starts to lose its vegetation, unless there's some extraordinary kind of effort on the part of governments there to try and maintain habitats or put extremely resilient plant life down, which I don't know if even that's possible when you start to talk about those temperatures. You're talking about basic uninhabitability for that period of time. And that's a real concern. And in the most extreme cases, you're also talking about exceeding human limits for survivability outdoors. You're talking about pushing wet bulbs above 35°C in many locations. And that's one of the things that happens when you start to warm the globe by more than 2 degrees Celsius.
And there are things we have to do outside. I mean, outside of agriculture, if you want to build something or fix something, you have to go out, and it's human nature to have to go out. So I think there comes a point, and I don't know when that point is yet, but thousands of people and then hundreds of thousands and then millions have to leave. And now it looks like Britain, the United States, and most European countries are closing up. Robert Marston Fanny, what happens when millions of people can't stay and can't find anywhere to go?
To that point, that region of the world does house, currently about 400 million people inhabit that region of the world. And when you start to make those regions uninhabitable, I mean, some people could probably still stay, but what you are doing is reducing the carrying capacity of those regions, unless there's an extremely huge amount of energy just spent building indoor habitats. So what you're talking about is tens of millions, likely hundreds of millions of people migrating. And what we saw after the Arab Spring and the food crises that happened in the Middle East and then the subsequent instability in places like Syria is minor by comparison. Unless there is some kind of amazing global effort to build terraformed indoor habitats for people that live in these regions, many of these people will move. And that creates a destabilization pressure for governments and for people that can't handle migration or won't handle migration or who are individually biased against people who need help or people who are different from who they are. And some countries do manage to deal with migrants well, but these societies tend to be both resource-rich and rich in kindness. And many societies tend to become more closed as multiple waves of migrants start to move through. And that is a destabilizing aspect. It tends to make politics more extreme. It tends to become, these poor victimized people tend to become scapegoats for people who are pandering to hatred. And that's just not a good picture. If we're going to confront climate change and if we're going to try and adapt to climate change, part of adaptation is learning to be kind to one another, to learn to share resources, not to hoard resources. And dealing with migration is something that we are going to have to do, even in the better case scenarios. So that's one of the threats that we really need to be aware of and we need to be honest about. We need to confront ourselves, to look into the heart of darkness and say, we refuse to be jerks. We refuse to turn these people away.
Well, we'll see. I'm not very optimistic about that myself. I see a source of great troubles coming from that. And we haven't even talked about rising seas. Like in Bangladesh, millions of people are going to have to move, and there's nowhere for them to go. I mean, India's already totally crowded on their borders and so on. So we're going to have to leave that one for another day. Well, now, Robert, I have to yell a bit, not at you, but at all of us. We have this fixation for records. There's been plenty broken in the last few years, but now, if something really dangerous is just continuing, but it's not an all-time record, we feel relieved. Maybe it's okay. We're a little bored. We've lost the appropriate emotion, which is rising fear. And 2016 was not a record year for increasing greenhouse gas emissions, we're told. But does that mean we're okay?
No, we're certainly not okay. So the reports are not conclusive, that there is some optimism baked in, but this needs to come with a few caveats. So what's happening is global coal use, it appears, and there's some pretty clear evidence that in many places around the world, coal plants are being shut down. And this is happening in the U.S., this is happening in Europe, this is happening apparently in China. China's had a number of policies that have targeted their least efficient coal plants, their dirtiest coal plants. And so what has happened as a result of this is it appears that since 2013, global carbon emissions have plateaued. It's possible that they may have grown a little slight amounts, I mean, but compared to the past growth rates, it's about stable. It may have dropped off. No one at this point can really put a clear pin in exactly where it is, because we're not too sure about the accuracy of data coming out of China. That said, it does appear that has happened, that we're basically on a plateau at record high global carbon emissions levels. So at record high global carbon emissions levels is not a good place to be. Where you want to be is global carbon emissions are falling. And when I say record high global carbon emissions, we are at in excess of 33 billion tons of CO2 hitting the atmosphere every year. We're talking about 50 billion tons of CO2 equivalent gases hitting the atmosphere every year. And that's insane. That's 10 times faster than the rate of carbon hitting the atmosphere during the last mass extinction, during the PETM in the past 65 million years. If you take all the global carbon emissions coming from the Earth system, from the environment in the past 65 million years, we are emitting at about 10 times, maybe as much as 20 times faster than the last time the world heated up really fast. So what the human world is doing is just nuts. And where we are right now is a bad place. It's better to be at a plateau in human emissions, but we should put this in perspective. We are still very, very, very far behind the eight ball when it comes to actually doing something that's going to prevent harmful climate change. And in order to do that, emissions need to fall to zero in a rather short period of time.
Well, or at least stop increasing every year, and they are increasing every year. And people don't understand that when you increase and increase, you get pretty big numbers within a decade or two decades, and that's still the track we're on.
What I will say is that we do have an opportunity right now. If you continue to shut down coal and you start moving on to other fossil fuel energy sources, you do have an opportunity to start to bend down that emissions curve. We have the technical means of doing that now, in the sense of actually replacing carbon-emitting energy with zero carbon-emitting energy or low carbon-emitting energy. And we also have the capability to start to replace the transportation and, to some extent, the manufacturing chains that are carbon-emitting. So if we're aggressive, we can actually start to bend that curve down now. But it would take India not building new coal plants. It would take China continuing to shut down coal plants and shutting them down at a pretty rapid pace, and shutting down coal plants on a global scale. And then from that point, moving to decarbonizing transport, starting to decarbonize ground transport. And in addition to that, it would be really helpful if we could get some efficiency policies out there that actually disincentivize the worst type of consumptive activities that produce carbon emissions. So we are kind of in a spot now where the growth of carbon emissions from the human source has taken a pause. And so the question is, are we as a society going to listen to all these, you know, all the people saying, well, no, we shouldn't be shutting down coal plants, or, you know, listening to the Trumps of the world, listening to the Abbotts of the world? You know, no, we shouldn't be attacking these industries. Or are we going to actually make progress? Or are we going to make the choice to shift away from harmful practices that are more harmful than the cigarette industry ever was, that through pollution alone result in 7 million deaths every year? Are we going to start to move away from that, take this opportunity to concertedly move away from that? We can do that now if we have the global political will.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with novelist, professional threat analyst, and top climate blogger Robert Marston Fanny. I often feed from his passionate but science-based posts on Robert Scribler's blog. All right, well, let's talk about your blog. Another positive thing that you find that I have failed to find, saying solar now produces a better energy return on investment than oil. Tell us about that.
So the Royal Society put out a study earlier this year that indicated that solar energy as a just a net energy producer was superior to oil. And now, don't get me wrong, net energy from oil is falling, and there's a lot of reasons for that. The first is that we are starting to rely more and more on unconventional sources of oil, sources like tar sands that require huge natural gas power plants just to heat up the bitumen, and sources like fracking that require a lot of mechanical energy, a lot of physical effort just to crack up the ground and force all those fluids down into the earth just to get the oil out. So the easy oil in many places is gone. There's no more self-pressurized fields where you just poke a hole in it and the oil just shoots out. So what's happened is that because you have to expend more energy to get the oil out of the ground, the energy return on energy invested for oil is falling. There is a technological process and a manufacturing process related to solar energy that both increases the efficiency of solar cells and increases the efficiency of producing solar cells, that actually reduces the net energy necessary to manufacture solar. And according to the Royal Society, the energy return on energy investment for solar is now around 15 to 1, and that oil is now about fallen below that figure. And so it appears that for net energy, there has been an inflection point, at least in this one study. Now, this is a scientific study, and it is the Royal Society, so I definitely listen to what they have to say. And in addition to that, the National Renewable Energy Labs in the U.S. have been producing similar studies in that vein for a number of years. Now, solar energy is an intermittent, like wind energy, and so there are other challenges related to solar energy. But it appears that at the very least, you can have systems that are running on 30%. If you're looking at systems that do not include storage, wind and solar energy, and if the systems are widely distributed, it does appear that that number could be bumped up to as high as 80%, according to the National Renewable Energy Labs in the U.S. So that requires some pretty amazing management systems for moving energy around and very large structures for trading energy. It appears that the opportunity based on cost, based on energy return, and if you start to add in technical energy trading capabilities like the smart grid, it appears that there are a number of building advantages for new renewable energy sources like wind and solar versus base fossil fuels. And you can start to see this in places like island nations. For example, Kauai recently started to add solar plus storage, and the cost of their solar plus storage is half the cost per kilowatt hour of diesel-based generation, which they were using before. And in many regions, it's making sense to add solar, which is one of the reasons why this year solar added around 60 gigawatts of new power capacity. Solar added around 70, and wind added around 60. So those are pretty impressive numbers for renewable energy. And if you also look at cost, and cost is in some ways related to energy return on energy investment, it's not always directly related. There are other market factors involved, but there is some exchange between the two. And if you look at cost, solar energy has just been falling on a price basis very rapidly, to the point now that there are some new solar projects that are starting off at 2.4, 2.3 cents per kilowatt hour in regions where there's abundant sunlight, and the operators feel that they can really crank out a lot of solar-based energy supplies.
Now, tied to that, you also did a blog about the sites of resistance, despite the shadow of Trumpiness creeping across America and the world. Where is that resistance happening? Where can we win a little?
Well, I'll just give you one example. California has been working very hard to try and decarbonize the system. Now, don't get me wrong. There's certain things about California's energy policies, say, for example, some policies that promote natural gas-based energy sources, that being a pure, being someone who focuses on more purist responses to climate change, I'm not necessarily happy with. But California itself is moving leaps and bounds forward when it comes to decarbonizing its energy. They are promoting numerous efficiency measures. They are promoting solar rooftops. They are promoting wind energy. They are promoting electric vehicles. And in many ways, California, if the U.S. was like California, our rate of emissions reductions wouldn't be 1 to 2% a year. They would be more in the range of 5 to 6% per year or more. And California has a goal to have its electricity powered 50% by renewable energy by 2030. And that's very positive. The governor, Jerry Brown, recently stated that he would continue these policies regardless of who was in the White House. And in addition, has stated that he would launch satellites if GISS satellites were defunded. So that's one example of a bright spot in the U.S. And there are numerous cities and states that are following similar pathways. There are many businesses that promote a response to climate change and a reductions in carbon emissions. And these businesses, 640, wrote a petition to Trump asking him not to back out of the Paris Climate Summit. So there are these bright lights in the darkness.
Well, speaking of bright lights, what about all those lights in Las Vegas, Nevada? I mean, that used to be the case for climate, people going mad thinking about that. What have they done there?
Well, in Las Vegas, the city has decided to run its city operations on 100% renewable energy when it comes to electricity-based energy sources. And I think that's very positive. Las Vegas is going to have to work very hard to be sustainable. They're in a tough spot when it comes to regions that will tend to be impacted more by climate change. And I think that the city realizes this, and they're working to promote 100% renewable power for their city. And there are numerous cities around the country that are doing the same thing.
We called our last program, I Have a Confession to Make. It was based on something that you'd written. And, you know, at this point, I have kind of a confession to make, and that is that when I started broadcasting this show in 2006, my idea was to campaign hard to stop climate change. And I was idealistic. I thought that the communication of science of climate change was a key barrier. I mean, surely once people know, they will demand action and start making changes to their own lives. But now it's 2017. Some scientists are telling me, frankly, right on air, that it's too late. The world is committed to a lot of warming. We are likely well past the danger line for humans and our co-species. And Sometimes I wonder, am I just here to chronicle the inevitable horror? Am I a horror writer now? Does it have to be that way?
So I think that if you look at life, Alex, it's both darker than we feared and more wonderful than we imagined. There is such a life surprises us. Our preconceptions are constantly destroyed, and so we need to be open to the potentials, not just the worst case, but the better case. So when you talk about inevitability, I would kind of step back from that. I would say what we're looking at is that we have some harms, some very rough harms that are locked in. But my personal opinion is that life can find a way, that humans, if we choose to do the right thing, have the capacity to face down this crisis and survive. Now, I'm not saying that I think it's going to be easy, but we are looking at least probable 2C warming this century in the better case scenarios. Even if we get our act together completely, we're probably looking at 2C, and unless we can somehow pull an amazing amount of carbon out of the atmosphere over a very short period of time. So 2C is bad. We're at 1.2C now, and we're starting to see some things fall off the boat. But 2C is at least two or three times as bad when it comes to geophysical impacts. So even if we manage to do the best, we're going to face hardship. We're going to face trouble. And the only way we're really going to get through this is if we manage to pull together. I'm not saying that's going to happen. If it doesn't happen, then we'll probably have a civilization collapse at least, even in the best case scenario. But if it does happen, I think that in many ways we might end up stronger over the long term. We will learn how to take care of this place that we call home, this place that is so precious to us that there is no green field of Mars that we can go off to and escape to. This is our home, and we're in a fight, whether we realize it or not, to save it from us. And if we fail, many of us, many of our children will not have prospects. Many people will probably perish, and not just because of climate, but because of the human system disruption that comes from it. But I don't know. I guess I can't give up. I can't just believe that we're just going to say, well, it's over. Our children aren't worth anything. All the things that we've done that are worthwhile aren't worth anything. All the people we love aren't worth anything. I can't believe that. I just can't believe that. Now, don't get me wrong. There are many people who are definitely in psychological denial. And there are many more people, I'm not saying like number-wise, but, you know, it's compared to number-wise. But there are a number of people out there that are trying to game the whole situation, that they think that they can come out ahead somehow. And in all honesty, you've got to just call bullshit on that. No one wins a zero-sum game when it comes to climate change. No one. You know, the wealthy are hated. Or they learn to exploit people and brainwash them to the point where it's we have no soul anymore. So the issue with climate change is it's the lesson that we have had to learn over the centuries. And some societies have done it, and some haven't. And those societies that do not fail, and those societies that learn to work together and to take care of the people who have been victimized and the creatures they've been victimized, and to take care of their environment, they survive. And that's what we are facing now. If we don't do it, we probably won't make it. But if we do, we've got a shot.
That's a huge and powerful vision. And I sort of hate to fall back to a tiny point, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the comments section in your blog, Robert Scribler's blog. And part of my theory is that when Joe Rome drew back from his famous Climate Progress blog, the educated commenters became homeless for a while, and then I think they got fired up by your blog. And, you know, incredible as it sounds, my web guy just told me that the Radio EcoShock website has a little script that so far has fended off 36,000 spam comments. And that's how intense the cyber war is out there. I figure every major oil, gas, coal pipeline company either has an office full of social media hacks or they hire some other company to do their dirty work and to stuff every channel and stuff our brains with doubt and nonsense. How do you manage to keep your blog comments climate science friendly while keeping out those fossil fools and the hostile robots?
Yeah, that's actually Mortal Kombat online. I whenever I go into the blog section of my comment, I have to be armored up emotionally. The comment section of my blog, I said combat. But it's weird because the people that I love on the blog, the people that I support on the blog, I have to be open to them. I have to do everything I can to give them a forum where they can express their concerns or meet others or connect. And the opposite of that is keeping out the wolves. And there are some very, very real wolves out there. There are people that either individually they have an axe to grind with regards to climate change for whatever reason, or they're a part of some institutional structure that is out there trying to spread misinformation. And that could be a nation, that could be a corporation. And what I have to do is I have to look at the way communication is being expressed to try and determine whether or not it's genuine. In many cases, I can look at certain talking points and just immediately delete comments that include those. So that's easy. There are more subtle comments that are either agitating or drop wedge issues into the forum that I tend to remove. And so what I have to do, though, is be active as a moderator continuously. And like you said, you get thousands of spam comments or what I consider to be malicious comments or comments from people that, you know, are themselves, you know, and the sad thing is that sometimes you just get people who are depressed and then they're just not going to make a positive contribution to the forum, and you have to decide whether or not to allow them to bring others into that spot with them or to try and continue to maintain a positive forum. And that is a huge challenge. And one of the reasons why I set up the Robert Scribler blog was to try and give people a safe place, to try and give people a chance to talk about climate change without having to constantly argue with climate change deniers about whether or not it warmed this year or whether or not global warming paused or just arguing over the latest point of disinformation, to actually be able to move forward and discuss the issue of climate change from the understanding that climate change is happening as the science has proved over and over again.
Tell us about one of your great contributors, a person that I followed. I got all kinds of links and sources from David T. Lang, and I was really sorry to see his stream of links stop and to hear that he passed away. Tell us about him and what he gave us.
So David began to contribute to the blog as a commenter back in 2014. And when he first came to the blog, he was very concerned about pollution, air pollution in particular. He had written his own blog on air pollution and had, well, he'd written numerous blogs, in fact. So one of them was, he had the handle Wind Spirit Keeper. But David was also very concerned about climate change. He had covered the issue on his blog, and he came to the blog with a passion. And he would post probably about 10 to 20 comments at least a day and linked to various media sources. And over time, it became, it seems to me that this was something more than just someone who was passionate about it. He would describe the wildfires in the Pacific Northwest as a result of recent warming events called the Ridiculously Resilient Ridge. There was a very persistent ridge of high pressure that pumped temperatures up to well above average and produced extraordinary wildfires in British Columbia, in Washington, in Oregon, in California. And when these wildfires would roll through, David would talk about how he could feel it, how he could feel the particulate in the air. It would be getting into his lungs. It was acrid. And he was very sensitive to it. And I think this in many ways informed his passion. He also lived as a surfer. He loved nature. He was a very, very smart individual. He He liked to share his thoughts with others, and in many ways he helped me. He went over to local radio and would talk about articles that I had written. And there was one time when, well, there was an issue where there were sea creatures that had died that were washing up on the shores, and I was interviewed on that issue because of both a blog I had posted, but also David just talking to people, calling people up and talking to them. So for the 2 years that I knew him, it seemed like that this was a critical part of his life. And when he passed away, we found out that he had it was due to cardiac arrest and organ failure, but that there were probably complications due to the fact that he had had trouble with his lungs for a number of years. And so when we talk about 7 million people perishing due to complications from air pollution every year, a lot of times that's just a statistic. But it's people we know. People we know that have heart attacks or strokes because their area might be more air polluted than another. People get emphysema or lung cancer as a result of the stuff that is belching out of these smokestacks. And to David, I think it was personal. He was trying to help others, but he was also, I think, trying to tell people something about himself.
Robert, we're starting to run out of time, and I could talk to you for hours, obviously, and I think it's partly because we are kindred spirits. I want to get in two quick points. The first is that I think what keeps both of us going is actually a sense of what well-being is and what good can be. And we have to know what good is to realize how badly things are going. Would you agree with that first point?
Absolutely. I don't know what else I can say to that. I think that if you don't know what good is, then you've got no light ahead of you. You've got nothing to move you forward. And so unless you've experienced something that is benevolent or have that life experience, then there's no real way to come up even with an ideal to move toward because you have no basis for it.
Well, the other necessary job qualification, I think, is the ability to keep having your mind broken. I mean, I see news or I'm reading science and it breaks me up again. How could this be? Can't everyone see what this means? And if I lose that, if I become jaded, then I will lose this show. I'll lose what makes Radio EcoShock. And I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that what you do, Alex, is very important. You listen and you share. And you learn. At the basis, I think that that's kind of where we all are. If we close ourselves off, if we don't talk about what scares us or what we're passionate about or what we love, then we become separated from life. We become a part of a collapsing circle. But the opposite of that is also true. If you're reaching out to others, if you're allowing your mind to be broken and changed by others and by facts and by what's happening, then though it's painful, you are growing, you're living, you're taking part of life and you're contributing back to it. And I really appreciate what you've done here and I think that your voice is very important. So I hope you don't stop.
Well, I'm not going to. I mean, it just hasn't happened. I'm astounded almost daily. So I've just got to keep doing this. I can't quit, and I don't think you can either. Well, we do have to wrap it up. We've been listening to and just talking with Robert Marston Fanny. He's a science fiction author and the host of Robert Scribbler's blog. You can find that at robertscribbler.com. That's pretty easy, robertscribbler.com. And I'll put a list of links to Robert's stories that we've talked about in the show and a couple that we didn't get to that I hope to. And I'll put that on my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much, Robert, and don't be a stranger. Let's talk a little bit more often. There's so much going on.
Well, I'm sorry. I get pulled in pretty hard, and I hyper-focus a lot, so I will definitely pop up more and more.
Radio EcoShock.
I want you to hear a short clip from a great podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, broadcast January 15, 2017. This clip features famous Penn State climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann.
From the Commonwealth Club of California, this is Climate One, changing the conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. I'm Greg Dalton. Mike Mann, I'd like to ask you about a real legitimate villain, perhaps. Frederick Seitz was former president of the National Academy of Sciences, president of Rockefeller University, won many awards. And he, you write in your book, The Madhouse Effect, is a founding figure in the art of modern-day science denialism. So tell us how such a distinguished figure, you know, went to the dark side.
Yeah, you know, I have some personal connections with Seitz in a sense. He was a solid earth physicist, a very distinguished, solid state physicist.
Flat earth.
So studying how materials work, and that's where I got my start in physics as well at UC Berkeley. I was studying in that area. And ultimately, he became president of the Rockefeller Institute, a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He actually became president of the National Academy of Sciences. So when people say, you know, well, how is it that, you know, somebody that smart cannot get it, cannot get the science of climate change? It's not a matter of intelligence. I think we have to recognize that. There are ideological issues at work. And in his case, he actually ended up receiving, I think, something like $70 million from R.J. Reynolds Tobacco to found an institute whose primary function would be to attack the science linking tobacco and human health. And there's a famous saying attributed to Upton Sinclair. It's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on not understanding it. And so I think we have to recognize that there is denialism that comes from exactly the place that Renee is describing. There are various strains of denialism. Some of it comes from, you know, a self-interested origin as well. And I think in some sense, that's the more challenging denialism to access and maybe convert and turn around, because it's so self-interested and it's so tied to ideology. I don't think any amount of information was going to convince the president, a former president of the National Academy of Sciences, that he was wrong about this science. I think he was absolutely convinced that he was right, and he was convinced that he was doing the right thing from a political standpoint. I think that's a harder nut to crack. I think it's a part of what we face, the fact that climate change denialism, that people like the electrician that we're talking about, as I said before, I see him as a victim of a campaign, a massive disinformation campaign. The same interests, some of the same talking heads who were working for the tobacco industry decades ago, denying the connection between tobacco and climate change, are today receiving money from fossil fuel interests to undermine the public's understanding and policymakers' understanding of the science of climate change. And suffice it to say that those people, to some extent, were operating in the shadows. Given the latest round of nominations for various departments in our presidency, those people may now be controlling the reins of government. And that's something we haven't seen before.
I'm Greg Dalton. I'd like to invite you to join the conversation on Twitter using our handle @ClimateOne. I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on podcasts and online. Thank you all for being part of this conversation today.
You can get that podcast, Is Climate Denial Destroying Our Planet?, from the Commonwealth Club of California for free on iTunes. We're out of time. I'm Alex. Please join me again next week on Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
So it's not just by chance that the gas canisters that are used in the West Bank and in other parts of Palestine showed up in Ferguson in 2013 or showed up in Oakland in 2014.
Resistance is what gives me hope, because resistance in and of itself is revolutionary. Resistance is what will save us.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Well, it's our first podcast of 2017, and it's hard to know where to begin in terms of assessing Donald Trump's policies towards indigenous people, black people, migrant people, people struggling with poverty, people with uteruses, working people, people who want to breathe clean air and drink clean water, and people under the thumb of expanding U.S. militarism and settler colonialism across the Middle East. As the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunima wrote earlier this week, since President Donald Trump entered the White House, Israel has announced a major new settlement push in the occupied West Bank. Occupation authorities gave final approval to almost 600 housing units for Jewish settlers in East Jerusalem on Sunday, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed there would be more to come. On Tuesday, the Israeli Defense Ministry followed up by announcing plans for 2,500 more units in settlements across the occupied West Bank. These decisions clearly stem from Israel's confidence that the Trump administration is likely to be even more pro-Israel than that of former President Barack Obama. We're going to be speaking with two activists who are having conversations with communities across the U.S. about the strengthening relationship between black liberation in the U.S. and liberation for Palestinians. But here's some more of the news from this week. Israeli soldiers shot and killed an unarmed Palestinian boy when he was running away from them last month, newly released video shows. The security camera footage published on Tuesday by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem shows Israeli forces firing on a group of youths during a night raid on Beit Rima, a village near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Ahmed Zaidani, 17, was killed, and a 25-year-old resident of the village was also shot and injured during the raid. 35 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli forces and private security guards last year, all but four of them in the West Bank. Defense for Children International Palestine called it the deadliest year for Palestinian children in the West Bank in the past decade. Last week, Israeli soldiers shot and killed Kusai al-Amur, 17, in Tuku, a village near the West Bank city of Bethlehem. Video from the scene shows Israeli soldiers violently dragging away the boy after he was shot. You can read more about these stories on electronicintifada.net. Meanwhile, Defense for Children International Palestine also reports that Israel has the dubious distinction of being the only country in the world that systematically prosecutes between 500 and 700 children each year in military courts, lacking fundamental fair trial rights. Children within the Israeli military system commonly report physical and verbal abuse from the moment of their arrest and coercion and threats during interrogations. The group says that it collected affidavits from 158 West Bank children detained and prosecuted under the jurisdiction of the Israeli military courts in 2016. The data shows that 62% of children endured some form of physical violence following arrest, and 52% were verbally abused, intimidated, or threatened. Of the 158 children, 25 were held in solitary confinement for an average period of 16 days, for interrogation purposes, an alarming increase over the previous year, the longest period of isolation for a child that DCI Palestine documented in 2016 was 29 days. Well, joining us to talk about Israel's ongoing abuses of the rights of children and how activists are working to highlight the intersection between fighting for justice for Palestinians and fighting for justice for people of color in the U.S. are two guests. Amanda Weatherspoon is a black liberation activist and is a minister with the Unitarian Universalist Church. And Nadia Tanous is a writer and an organizer. Both of them are from the San Francisco Bay Area and are on a speaking tour across the U.S. organized by Friends of Sabeel North America. Amanda and Nadia, so good to have you both on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you. So good to be here, Nora.
So you're joining us from Detroit. Actually, you just touched down there a couple hours ago, and there was actually supposed to be a third member of your speaking tour. Tell us about Ahed Tamimi, who she is and why she's not on tour with you.
Yeah, Ahed is a 16-year-old from the village of Nabi Saleh in the West Bank. And she is an amazing activist, a really courageous person, and extremely charismatic. We had first envisioned that she would come and speak on the speaking tour in January. It was planned out around her winter break schedule. And we applied for her visa around October 2016. We got notice from the U.S. consulate that they were putting her visa in administrative review, which is a black box. You can't see into it. You can't add in files. Nobody that we talked to in the consulate seemed to have enough seniority to be able to look inside and tell us what was going on. Her visa is still in administrative review, and we are awaiting an answer from the U.S. consulate.
Tell us more about Ahed and what's going on in Nabi Saleh and what's Ahed's activism look like?
Oh, yeah. So the village of Nabi Saleh is, again, in the occupied West Bank, is located near a fresh water well. And this fresh water well is a huge resource for the village, but it's also a big magnet for the local settlement of Halmish. So since 2009, the villages of Nabi Saleh, including Ahed herself, even though she was just a child, as well as her father and her mother, Basim and Nerima and Tamimi, led these nonviolent protests in the village down to the water well in order to send a message that they weren't going to let the water well be taken from them by the local settlement. And as we know, the settlement of Halmish has been expanding. And so in terms of why Ahed was chosen, why she wanted to go on this tour around the United States, is because she sees everyday struggle. She herself has been incarcerated. Many of her family members have been incarcerated. And she's seen many things on a firsthand basis. But furthermore, she also sees the intersectionality between the struggle of people of color here in the United States and Palestinians there in Palestine. And she speaks to that herself. It's incredible. She's only 16. She has so much wisdom and so much life experience. We were videotaping Ahed once we realized about 5 days before the tour started that she was not going to be able to come to join the tour. We decided that, you know, instead of stopping the tour and contributing to her silencing, we were actually going to amplify her voice. We said, no, we're going to go forward. We're not going to put it on hold. There's no guarantee of when this visa will come through. So we're going to have her talk to people in her own voice. And so in a period of 5 days, we had a professionally taped video, an interview from a Palestinian director in 48. It was edited by a Palestinian American in New York, and it was translated by me and my family. And a lot of the B-roll, she speaks to the intersectionality between the struggle for Palestinian justice and the struggle for liberation of Black and Mexican Americans and Native Americans and Arab Americans and people of color in the United States.
That's the voice of Nadia Tanous. Nadia and Amanda, let's talk about the tour, No Child Behind Bars, Living Resistance from U.S. to Palestine. Tell us about why you're touring the country and amplifying Ahed's voice and what kinds of conversations you're having, especially at this moment in time when Donald Trump is in the White House being aided by white supremacists and ultra-conservatives. Trump is also threatening to send in the feds to cities like Chicago and is seeking to expand militarized police forces while cutting social services, health care, everything is on the table. And this is, of course, after 8 years of the Obama administration setting up these kinds of structures, including being the most pro-Israel administration in history so far. Amanda, tell us about why you're on this tour. Why now?
Well, I think that people are in a position where they're really ready. They're ready to act. They're ready to get out there, to be mobilized. People who previously really weren't are out in the streets, are out in the hundreds of thousands. And so this is a really important time, just politically. Our tour is not in reaction to the election of Donald Trump, but it certainly falls during a time when people are kind of ready. And so our tour, a lot of what we do on this tour is we talk about foundational issues. We talk about how things connect. We talk about frameworks. So while we are focusing on Palestine and the U.S. in terms of state-sponsored violence against youth and children, we do this through an intersectional approach. So, you know, we talk about militarizing of the police. We talk about the fact that, you know, the U.S. incarcerates more people per capita than anywhere in the world. We talk about what structural racism is and the role that that plays. We talk about dehumanization and criminalization of youth. So we do talk about the issue of the apartheid in Palestine and the apartheid in the U.S., but we do it looking at frameworks and connections. I think right now that's really important for people. I think people are starting to really engage these issues in a way that they haven't before. And that's very important to keep us sustained in the days and weeks and years to come with the work that we have to do.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is kind of a full circle for me because I was hired by Friends of Study in 2013 as a researcher, actually, into child detention issues in Palestine. And at the time, I was called forward to find a company target. You know, who's responsible? Who is profiting off of this system? And so we found and we focused on, as you know, Nora, G4S, Group 4 Security Corps. And, you know, it's so funny because we targeted them, we went after them, we really talked about their complicity and their profiteering in the juvenile military tort system, but also in terms of their contracts with ICE and with the private prison system here in the United States. And so it, you know, a couple months before this tour started, G4S put out a notice that they were going to withdraw all of their contracts from the state of Israel that had to do with supplying prisons. Now, we know that they are still invested and they still have a contract with the new Israeli Police Academy in East Jerusalem. They signed a 25-year contract in 2015, and that still resides. So they're still a BDS target. But, you know, for G4S in any regard to make any sort of move to terminate their contract in Israel, I mean, that is a huge success.
We're speaking with Amanda Weatherspoon and Nadia Tanous. They're on a speaking tour called No Child Behind Bars, Living Resistance from the U.S. to Palestine, and they're speaking to us from Detroit. Amanda, what can be done? What kinds of solutions are there in terms of, you know, really strengthening radical activism, in terms of strengthening that kind of resistance that creates justice from the U.S. to Palestine? What kinds of organizational strategic tactics are you looking at and are people talking about when you're having these conversations with them across the U.S.?
Well, I think it depends. It depends on the arena that we're focusing on and the issue that we're focusing on. But I can say that it always will come down to coalitions and communities working together. There's power in communities. There's power in grassroots. Too often we wait for the powers that be to make decisions that will positively affect us. And I think we're seeing that that's not really something we can wait on any longer, because that is the system that you have to buy into. And most of us don't have the capital to buy into it. So focusing on the power of communities. So that can be coalitions, that can be, you know, communal farming, communal living, taking care of one another, collectives, anything that involves people working together. And while it is hard and it's difficult and it's messy and complicated, I feel like no matter what changes we enact, no matter what kind of mobilization efforts or activism or organizing that we do, it's got to come from the connections between people. People have to be working together and mobilizing and working as a team in this new political climate. We can't be individualized anymore.
Nadia, same question.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of it comes back to organizing, just like Amanda said. We have to look at what our separate challenges are, but also how they intersect, right? So when we talk about liberation in Palestine and liberation in the United States for POC communities, it's not just parallel, right? Like, you can parallel lots of things. We talk about how zones A, B, and C in the West Bank and zoning, right, is reflected here through redlining of the hood, for example, and different borders and how people are excluded from resources or work or access. And so there are definitely parallels, but the most powerful thing really is that it's interconnected. You know, we bring up militarization of the police a lot. And part of this is because it's an ongoing, it's always been happening, but in our globalized world, everything is so connected. So it's not just by chance that
the gas canisters that are used in the West Bank and in other parts of Palestine showed up in Ferguson in 2013 or showed up in Oakland in 2014, right? Like, these are not just coincidences. These are things that are kind of, they're synced up by militaries and police around the world. And I think when we go and we speak to people in universities, in churches, in union halls, in so many of the locations where we have the privilege to speak to people, we're really focusing on, okay, here are the systems of oppression. Here's why they target people. It's not just a case-by-case basis. They're much more insidious than that. Here's how they profit from your suffering. You know, in the exact same ways, in many cases, the same system. And this is how you take that down. This is how you deconstruct that. Those are the types of conversations we're really having with communities. Not just pointing out that these things are parallel, but that they're interconnected. And then being interconnected, where they're actually easier to take down because it's the same bricks of this wall.
Finally, same question to both of you. What gives you hope right now? What, you know, motivates you? What's one single thing that you can point to that helps you get up in the morning and do the work that you do?
The sheer power of people. The resistance and the resilience. As a Black woman, resistance just in my bones through my ancestors, and the insurmountable odds that have been overcome by people of color, by Indigenous people here in the United States, by Black people who were brought in chains, always finding a way to survive and resist, making connections with each other, laughing, smiling, living, talking, waking up. Resistance is what gives me hope, because resistance in and of itself is revolutionary. Resistance is what will save us.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And Nadia?
There's so much power in the things and the people that have come before us. So, you know, this is a really bad situation right now. The news that comes out every day, it just seems to get worse. But the thing is that it's been very, very bad before. And people have found ways. Our ancestors have survived. They have struggled. They have found methods, you know, of getting through, and not just getting through, but making themselves better. And I think what gives me hope is the idea that this next generation, you know, the generation of Ahed and myself and Amanda, you know, we are going to reach emancipation that our grandparents could not reach as much as they tried. And that our next generation, right, the generation that comes after us, we might not have to re-educate them on so many things, because they might learn it right the first time, and they might be wiser, and they might be more creative and inventive and find the keys to liberation that we couldn't find in our try. But I do have hope. I do have the belief that our generation, the generation of Ahed and Amanda and myself, we will reach emancipation. We will take it. And we are active. We are actors, rather, in it, and therefore we have a path, and we know where we need to go. And it's, like Amanda said, it's not easy, it's messy, but we have to do it. We're called to this work, and the time is now. Amanda said something that's so striking to me on the tour. She says, the revolution is happening right now, and 50 years down the line, we're going to know what it's called. But right now is when the revolution is happening. So everything that you do and everything that you decide or connect with, every person you connect with, it matters, because it's part of the revolution. So don't wait for it. It's happening right now.
Well, with that, that's Nadia Tanous. She's a writer and an organizer, along with Amanda Weatherspoon, a Black liberation activist and minister with the Unitarian Universalists. They're both on a speaking tour called No Child Behind Bars, Living Resistance from the U.S. to Palestine. Where can people go to get more information on the tour and hopefully come see you speak?
Yeah, if you go on to either FOSNA.org's page, that's FOSNA.org, or in Facebook, you can type in No Child Behind Bars,
Poland, living resistance from the U.S. to Palestine. We are in our ninth event. We're on our way to University of Michigan Dearborn, and we have 19 cities on this tour in 23 days. So please check, make sure if we're going through your city, spread the word, come on out. We would love to engage with you.
Awesome. And again, that website is FOSNA, F-O-S-N-A, Friends of Sabeel North America .org. Nadia and Amanda, thank you so much for all you do and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much, Nora. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you. And many thanks to Sharif Zakut for the new intro music. Thanks, all of you. And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present interviews with protesters on Inauguration Day who explain why they'd come to Washington, D.C. to oppose Donald Trump and his agenda. Climate activist Tim DeChristopher, who talks about the urgency of taking personal risks to protect the planet in the era of climate change denial promoted by President Trump and his administration. And Aaron Sherb of Common Cause, who discusses Donald Trump's many unresolved financial conflicts of interest and a federal lawsuit that claims his overseas businesses violate the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Further evidence of increasing global inequality can be found in a new report by the international aid group Oxfam, which says that the world's eight wealthiest billionaires, including Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Mark Zuckerberg, have amassed as much wealth as the poorest half of the world's population, some 3.6 billion people. Oxfam's report, An Economy for the 99%, was released on the eve of the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland, a gathering of the international business and political elite. Oxfam's research has revealed that over the last 25 years, the top 1% has gained more income than the bottom 50% put together, and almost half, 46%, of total income growth went to the richest 10%. This is important because the poorest 10% of the global population still live below the extreme poverty line of $1.90 a day. This comes at the same time that President Trump plans to cut corporate taxes, weaken regulations, and make it easier for rich families to avoid taxes by exploiting tax havens. Oxfam's director, Winnie Byanyima, declared, "Wages are stagnating, and corporate bosses take home million-dollar bonuses. It's obscene for so much wealth to be held in the hands of so few." The Dodd-Frank Act was passed in the aftermath of the 2008 financial meltdown, which brought big Wall Street banks to the brink of collapse. Dodd-Frank reforms, passed by Congress in the early days of the Obama administration, shored up the big banks and identified systemic risk in the nation's shattered financial system. However, the Dodd-Frank legislation avoided fundamental change, such as breaking up the big banks or reimposing the Glass-Steagall Act that separated commercial lending from investment banking. Among its reforms, Dodd-Frank created the Independent Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and established the Volcker Rule that restricted U.S. banks from making certain kinds of speculative investments. According to the American Prospect magazine, as of last summer, 25% of Dodd-Frank rules had not been completed. This included rules governing executive compensation and new powers for the clawback of executive bonuses resulting from corporate misconduct. However, the Trump administration, which has innumerable conflicts of interest with international banks, has promised a new wave of financial deregulation and could begin by simply telling enforcement agencies to stop working on completing unfinished Dodd-Frank rules and regulations. Red State Texas is the next stop for debate over the so-called bathroom bill. Yet its prospects are uncertain, as the Lone Star State's powerful business community is opposed to the measure, fearing a backlash and boycotts. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, a Tea Party favorite, introduced the bathroom bill in early January. It closely resembles the controversial North Carolina law that required transgender people to use the bathroom corresponding to the sex on their birth certificates. The bill would also ban Texas municipalities from passing laws requiring or preventing private businesses from setting their own policies on how or whether to accommodate the different sexes in their bathrooms. Many Texas conservatives oppose the bathroom bill. Texas House Speaker Joe Strauss says the bill is not a priority, and the powerful Texas Association of Business calls the bill discriminatory and totally unnecessary legislation. Based on the boycotts targeting North Carolina's bathroom bill, Texas business lobbyists fear the bill could cost the state $8 billion in lost business, including the loss of the contract to host the lucrative NCAA Final Four games in San Antonio in 2018. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Not long after the November 8th election, thousands of Americans took to the streets in protest of a presidential election that many believe was stolen by an undemocratic, archaic electoral college system that installed Republican candidate Donald Trump in the White House, despite the fact that he had lost the popular vote by some 2.8 million ballots. Adding to the anger and fear across the country was Trump's unabashedly racist, xenophobic, and misogynist rhetoric that at times provoked violence targeting protesters who attended his campaign rallies. As the nation held its collective breath, waiting to see what a Trump presidency would bring, anti-Trump activists got busy organizing protest rallies to coincide with the presidential inauguration on January 20th. The most ambitious of these was what later came to be called the Women's March on Washington, which grew out of a modest effort launched on a Facebook page. Exceeding all expectations, the Women's March on January 21st swelled to become the largest national political protest in U.S. history. Protesters attending rallies in 673 cities and small towns in all 50 states across the U.S., as well as cities abroad, totaled more than 4 million, with one research team estimating that an amazing 1 in 10 Americans had joined one of the anti-Trump demonstrations that day. Between the Lines covered the protests in Washington, D.C., during the inauguration of Donald Trump, and the Women's March, which took place the following day. What follows is a series of brief interviews with people who explain in their own words why they had come from near and far to express opposition to Donald Trump and his agenda. We hear first from Robin, Kathleen, and Denise from North Carolina.
I was just wanting to know what brought you here today.
Injustice and fear for my country and the world and the viability of our planet.
We are very concerned about Trump being president and the damage that he potentially can do to our country and human rights in general.
We believe that this president is unfit, that he was really illegally placed in office, that there a lot of things happened before the election that were not kosher with the FBI investigation, with possible Russian hacking. We believe he really shouldn't be in office, that he really was illegally elected. We think he doesn't believe in science. He doesn't believe in global warming. He's a racist. He's a misogynist. We're very, very unhappy. So we drove from North Carolina to be here today to say no to Trump.
Peter from Washington, D.C. is a Vietnam veteran.
My sign says this veteran is embarrassed and ashamed and will resist.
Tell us a little bit what brought you out to the protest today at the inauguration.
I'm finding that President-elect Trump, soon-to-be President Trump, is probably the least qualified person ever to serve as president. I find him morally repugnant. I find him lacking in intelligence and curiosity and just ill-informed on so many policy issues. And I think it's important for the American people to come together, recognize what we're facing, the challenges we're facing, and to organize ourselves to prevent him from doing much damage over the next 4 years.
Pat traveled to Washington from New Fairfield, Connecticut.
My sign says, one person, one vote does not equal Donald Trump. He didn't. If we have a true democracy, it should be one person, one vote. He did not win the election. If we have a true democracy, we've got a plutocracy, we've got people who buy influence in government, we have people who gerrymander in rig elections. It's wrong. Why do the poor people on the West Coast even bother to vote? They're part of the country. It's wrong.
Ben, who lives in New York City, explains why he came to protest at the Trump inauguration.
Why I'm here today is so that all of the supporters of him can see the opposers, and so that they can at least see that there are people who are willing to come out here and say, no, we don't support this, as many as there are that say we do support this, so that then maybe they'll think twice before they say that harmful thing towards that person, or they commit that harmful act. They'll think twice about their actions.
What are you planning to do over the next 4 years? Are you going to remain active? And if so, what is going to be your focus?
My focus right now ideologically is on the environment, because that's what I worry about the most. Of course, we all know that he has promised to pull out of the Paris Accords, and he has appointed someone in his cabinet that's the CEO of Exxon. So things were already looking bleak before that. I think that's what I'm going to try to keep at the forefront of my mind over the next 4 years, because without a good infrastructure and without a good environment to sustain all of this and to sustain all this debate, how much of it matters? That's what I have to ask.
We next hear from Melinda of Frederick, Maryland.
What's your big concern about Trump?
Everything he stands for, the entire Trump agenda. Number one thing is him and Pence trying to control women's bodies. Not even my husband controls my uterus. So neither will Congress, not the president, nobody will control what I do with my body. And then how they stand with immigrants. I'm half an immigrant. My dad's from El Salvador. My husband's from Asia. What, does he want to deport us? Everything that he stands for is just not right. It's not right.
And what is your plan for the next 4 years? How are you going to be active on these issues?
I'm just pretty scared, to be honest. I'm just worried and just people coming together, just coming together wherever people can. That's where I'll be, just fighting the Trump agenda, because we won't be able to accomplish anything unless we stand together and fight.
That was a series of interviews with people from all walks of life who came to Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day to express their opposition to Donald Trump and his agenda. Learn more about the ongoing organizing being done by the Women's March Coalition and other groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Climate activist Tim DeChristopher spent 21 months in federal prison for a creative nonviolent direct action in 2008 that succeeded in stopping the auctioning of public lands in Utah for fossil fuel development. In 2015, he co-founded the Climate Disobedience Center, which works with groups and individuals who risk imprisonment for breaking the law in the interest of protecting the climate. This center's current focus is assisting five individuals in their support team who on October 11th last year turned off the valves of five pipelines that bring tar sands oil from Canada into four U.S. states. They're facing several criminal charges, including conspiracy, burglary, and trespass. In advance of the action, they took safety precautions and notified the pipeline companies. The group is now facing up to 30 years in prison. DeChristopher says these cases will test the rights of political dissidents in the Trump era. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with DeChristopher while on a break from painting banners in Washington, D.C., that would be used in a protest during the January 20th inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th President of the United States. Here, Tim DeChristopher discusses the urgency of taking risks to protect the climate, and thereby human beings and other Earth species, who rely on a healthy, sustainable environment for survival.
A big part of our philosophy is trying to use the whole process of a civil disobedience action, not just up to the point of arrest, but through the trial, through jail support, through all of that, and to support folks through that whole process and help to make the most out of it for the movement as well.
Do you see any increase in the number of actions that are, you know, resulting in people going to trial as opposed to just paying a fine or doing community service?
Yeah, I think so. There's been a big increase in civil disobedience across the climate movement for the past 6 or 7 years now. And the first wave of that was a lot of the kind of catch-and-release style, prearranged kind of actions. And I think a lot of the people who got involved in those then got a taste of it and realized, oh, there's other opportunities here. There's more that we could be doing. So then as those people kind of grow as activists, then they try new ways of making their voices heard. And what happens out in the street is sort of one format of telling our story. And as folks have had some level of success with that, but realizing that, you know, we need to keep pushing harder, people have looked for new formats. And the courtroom is one of those formats where we can also tell our story and make our voice heard in a very different kind of way. And so a lot more folks, I think, are trying that and are having various levels of success in terms of how much of their story they're allowed to tell in the courtroom, particularly how much they're allowed to tell to juries rather than just to the judge. And I think that's something that particularly in the Trump era, where we can get less and less positive results from our government officials and even government appointees and judges and things like that, I think we're going to be looking for more ways that we can rely on each other as citizens. And juries are one of those pieces of the system where we can actually support each other and protect each other's rights, no matter what draconian laws are passed, that we can say, no, as citizens, we're not going to enforce that on each other. We're not going to send people to prison for their identity or for their religion or for their political beliefs or their expression of their political beliefs in public spaces. And, you know, I think that's the kind of solidarity that we're going to be looking for more and more. And so I think it's important for folks to get that practice now. The judge and the prosecutor act like the juries are just there to enforce the will of the state, when the reality is that the role of a jury is to protect our fellow citizens from the government. That's what they're there for, is to protect fellow citizens from the government. If we trusted the government, we wouldn't need juries. That's why they're there. And I think particularly a lot of liberals have gotten into the habit of trusting the government. And I think now that puts us in an extremely vulnerable situation when we have such a hostile government that really just has no respect for our rights whatsoever. And so we need to get back in the habit of protecting ourselves from tyranny.
The concept of necessity defense, where people say, even admit to breaking a law, but said, you know, I broke the law to prevent a greater harm, which in this case, as you deal with, would be to try to stop the exploitation and burning of fossil fuels, which, you know, are cooking the planet and among many other ills. So is that the basis of the defense that the different groups are using, or are there all kinds of issues that they're using?
There are all kinds of defenses that folks are using. The necessity defense is one that fits very well with climate change, and certainly one that is kind of the go-to defense that we in the Climate Disobedience Center like to use when we get the opportunity. And the necessity defense as a technical thing in legal terms is something that has to be allowed by a judge. You know, it's to make that defense openly in court where the judge gives the jurors instructions that they can acquit if they find that the defendant met the requirements of the necessity defense. That's pretty rare in civil disobedience cases and has yet to be successfully used for climate civil disobedience. But the basic concept of the necessity defense interpreted more broadly can be used even when the judge doesn't explicitly set up that situation to openly use the necessity defense. That argument can still be worked into a lot of different kinds of defenses. And there are variations on the necessity defense in terms of tapping into international law and the Nuremberg principles and things like that that can all be explored. But, you know, I think it's an area that our movement hasn't put a whole lot of resources and effort into. So there's still a lot of ground for experimentation and creativity there.
That was Tim DeChristopher of the Climate Disobedience Center. Learn more about the upcoming trials of the five climate activists involved in the October 11th pipeline shutdown action, including Climate Disobedience Center co-founder Ken Ward, whose trial begins on January 31st, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Well before his victory in the November 8th presidential election, many legal observers expressed concern about billionaire real estate developer Donald Trump's potential for serious ethics violations should he win the White House. These conflicts include Trump and his family members' possible exploitation of the office of president for self-enrichment, and how the potential for profit and loss in the Trump business empire could influence his decisions on both domestic and foreign policy. After taking the oath of office on January 20th, the president has reiterated his refusal to address these conflicts, as previous presidents have done, through mechanisms such as the liquidation of all assets and then moving the proceeds to a blind trust. Instead, Trump says he'll transfer the day-to-day management of his business and wealth over to his two adult sons, Don and Eric. On the Monday following his inauguration, a federal lawsuit was filed by the nonpartisan group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, that asked the court to stop Trump from violating the Constitution's Foreign Emoluments Clause by illegally receiving payments from foreign governments with ties to Trump interests. Your reporter spoke with Aaron Sherb, Director of Legislative Affairs with Common Cause. Here he discusses Trump's conflicts of interest, lack of transparency, and what's at stake in the outcome of the recently filed federal lawsuit.
What we're really seeing with the Trump administration is an unprecedented amount of secrecy in any modern American presidency, and as well as from the Republican Congress. I think from Trump not releasing his tax returns, despite calls from Republicans, Democrats, independents across the country encouraging him to, despite that all modern American presidential candidates have released their tax returns, he has refused to do so. We've also called on him to fully divest his Trump organization, his 500-plus business entities that he is connected with or has an ownership stake in, and he's assigned that to his two sons, and that's neither blind nor trustworthy when your two sons are managing your assets, and they know full well what decisions he's making, and that we think that's a vast, significant conflict of interest that has to be addressed, or else he's going to quickly lose faith of the American people in his presidency. All modern American presidents in recent years have put their assets in a blind trust or similar entity, I think, for the past 40 plus years. And he will be the first president not to do that. And we think that's a significant kind of, even though it's not legally required, it's kind of breaks with kind of cultural and political norms that sets a dangerous precedent for where American democracy could head.
Aaron, I've read that this emoluments clause in the U.S. Constitution is not court tested, and a counsel hired by the Trump administration basically has given him a pass on his refusal to either liquidate his assets or put them in a blind trust. What can you tell us about your reading of the U.S. Constitution versus Trump's advisory team?
Yeah, well, like you said, it's untested. We've never been in a situation like this before. And like you said, Crewe had filed a lawsuit alleging that President Trump was violating the emoluments clause for his ownership of the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. specifically, and that foreign governments, there's one case where foreign governments had planned to stay at another hotel, then they changed their reservation to stay at the Trump Hotel. And so it's difficult to kind of prove standing or to prove harm in this case. And again, since there's no real precedent to go off of, it's kind of uncharted territory that we're in. And so we're kind of taking a wait and see approach. So while we work with Crewe a lot of the times, we're still, our lawyers are still kind of exploring how he might be in violation of the emoluments clause and looking at sort of other actions or kind of other remedies, just because it would be a extremely long, potentially long court battle, but it would certainly be an uphill challenge, though. I should say that the Crewe is headed by former ethics czar from the Obama administration, as well as the former ethics czar from the George W. Bush administration. So it's, they both have, having that bipartisan credibility certainly gives a lot of weight to their lawsuit.
Aaron, just a final question. There seems to be a lot at stake here, given the fact that Donald Trump is the first president in modern American political history who's refused to release his taxes and has refused to liquidate his assets or place them in blind trust, really defying the tradition of presidents that preceded him. If Donald Trump gets away with this, could this open the floodgates to devolution of ethics in government, not only for the office of president, but right on down the line to many other positions in the legislature and the like?
Yeah, and that's what Common Cause is concerned about and paying particular attention to, so that he hopefully has not kind of created a new political norm in not only the presidency, but for other elected offices. You might have seen the attention that he, or kind of the fire he's directed at the entity called the Office of Government Ethics, which helps ensure that federal officials don't have conflicts of interest and helps federal nominees and other federal workforce employees make sure that they don't have certain conflicts and kind of certifies them before they're able to start their job. And he's threatened to fire the head of this fairly small organization because it has been asking difficult questions of some of his cabinet officials and other federal employees. And so that's, again, just a extremely troubling sign. Concerned citizens around the country can contact their members of Congress to encourage them to support certain legislation that would help eliminate some of these conflicts of interest that the Trump administration has.
I'm not sure we named them, but just maybe summarize them quickly here before we have to go.
Yeah, so a couple of key things that we're focused on is trying to require the presidential candidates to disclose tax returns. That's not legally required, but it's certainly ingrained in American political culture. Another effort would ensure that presidents would have to release their personal financial disclosure forms the first year that they're in office. And like I said, again, the Office or the Ethics in Government Act doesn't require presidents to do that until the almost a year and a half after they've taken office. And again, with President Trump, just given his vast financial fortunes, the American public deserves to see how his businesses are potentially profiting in the first year and a half in office. So we just need as many concerned citizens as possible to continue to highlight these critical issues to make sure that our American democracy can be strengthened and solidified.
That was Aaron Sherb, Director of Legislative Affairs with Common Cause. Find more analysis of Trump family financial conflicts of interest by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis
of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Our Lives Matter, a review. Rob G. Kelly's new work of poetry screams from its cover, Our Lives Matter. In an era of the black youth movement, often termed Black Lives Matter by the corporate press, and in fact formally named the Movement for Black Lives, this work seems especially written for them, for many of the motivating factors that drove black youth into the streets with fevered protest and the often fragile demonstrations fraught with danger. Here I want to recall the Ferguson example, where men, women, and children were confronting cops armed with weapons of war. They echo here with the names of Mike Brown, Rekia Boyd, Freddie Gray, and are the stuff and meat of poems, hymns to the dead. Kelly's poems are prayers written on paper and cast into the winds of fate like kites or chicks tossed from the steel nest of prison. He shares his pain, his dreams, his visions, and his hopes in these poems, which are as interesting as they are inventive. Imagine how he teases and caresses words in a poem with the surprising title, Tonight I Date the Rain. Kelly is a sober young man who has spent enough time in the bowels of prison to feel and express not just his longing, but his highest, most sacred hope, a way of living for Africans in America. He often uses the term Nubians, without the ever-present sense of dread. Divided into three sections, he creates a triangle of lust, righteous indignation, and the tenderest of loves. He's smart enough and savvy enough to respect and to elevate his elders who have inspired him, like Gwendolyn Brooks and Sonia Sanchez. If you enjoy reading poetry, Our Lives Matter may be the next book for you to buy and feed upon to enrich and nourish the soul. If you want the book, it's available from smashwords.com. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jabal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Women march against Washington. They covered the streets like rain. Women in hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions. Millions marched in almost 700 cities across America and in world capitals from Paris to Antarctica. Millions against Trump. Millions against Trumpism. I'd read that it was planned to follow the bleak and blustering inauguration. But who knew it would be this vast? If ever anyone wondered what millions of women thought of the new American president, they answered in a thousand thunderclaps. From toddlers in strollers to crones in wheelchairs and everyone in between, women poured into the streets of the Capitol and in hundreds of cities to denounce President Trump, coochie grabber in chief. Not since President Bush announced an invasion of Iraq have we seen such a spectacle. Seldom have people demonstrated so clearly against an elected politician. To anyone who saw it, such a sight will not be soon forgotten. Their signs ran from the silly to the serious, but almost all referenced women's demand for equal rights and freedom. They demonstrated, by their sheer magnificent numbers, that women are a force to be reckoned with. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you.
What does the elevation of Donald Trump and his policies on trade mean for the global economy? What will dramatic reductions of the corporate tax rate in America mean for the most financially compromised Americans? What were the real reasons Trump prevailed over Clinton in the recent elections? Does the recent round of executive orders on the U.S.-Mexico border wall, immigration policy, pipelines, and other initiatives bring us any closer to understanding the agenda of the deep state forces which secured his election? Do the recent high-profile spats with the CIA suggest that Trump's days in office may be numbered? On this edition of the Global Research News Hour, we continue our discussion from last time about the incoming Trump administration, where its policies will take us, and what they mean for America and the world. We'll hear perspectives from PhD economist Rodrigue Tremblay and from political watcher and commentator Stephen Lendman. On this week's program, Trump and the Deep State, Part 2. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 27th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, an occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. U.S. War Crimes Act and 18 U.S.C. sections 818 and 3231 punish torture, willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health, and inhuman, humiliating, or degrading treatment. And the torture statute criminalizes the commission, attempt, or conspiracy to commit torture outside the United States. Trump said he would approve the use of waterboarding, quote, in a heartbeat, unquote, because, quote, only a stupid person would say it doesn't work, unquote. But even if it doesn't work, he added, quote, they deserve it anyway for what they're doing, unquote. Trump, who relies on alternative facts, quote unquote, probably doesn't care if torture works to get the real facts. That comes from the article State-Sanctioned Torture in the Age of Trump by Marjorie Cohn, posted January 26th, originally appearing at Truth Out. Peru is clearly aware that South America is sailing through turbulent waters and is, at the same time, affronted by an aggressive campaign to harass it. In addition to economic woes, the region is the victim of a powerful offensive driven from outside that seeks, through all kinds of means, to consolidate Washington's presence. U.S. military incursions in the region are advancing at an accelerated pace. This is partly due to several governments turning to the right, especially after Mauricio Macri assumed the presidency of Argentina and the parliamentary impeachment of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, and partly due to the tireless effort to undermine the influence of countries such as China, Russia, and Iran. Arming Peru right to the teeth represents a vital pawn for the United States to succeed further down the line in setting up other military bases in Argentina at its border with Brazil and Paraguay. That comes from the article, South America Under Threat, U.S. to Set Up a New Military Base in Peru, by Ariel Noyola Rodriguez, posted January 26th, translated by Anusha Borolesa for Voltaire Network. The march failed so far in the sense that Trump is president, but it succeeded in the sense that a pacified population could let off steam and publicly disapprove of Trump. I don't follow MSM, so I don't know all the stories invented about Trump, apart from golden showers or whatever the allegation was. But Trump says he wants peace with Russia, and he talks about dissolving the NATO terror organization, etc., which is preferable to war criminal Hillary's threats against Syria and Iran and the world. Meanwhile, amidst the spectacles, the distractions, and the controlled opposition, the slaughters and beheadings and genocide continue apace overseas. voices from what remains of the quote-unquote progressive movement are barely audible, and the quote-unquote left has been almost completely co-opted. That comes from the article Women's March for Misogyny by Mark Taliano, posted January 26th. The idea of establishing a quote-unquote safe zone in Syria is, of course, not a new concept. In July 2015, the agreement being discussed would have effectively created a buffer zone that would have spanned from the Turkish border line into Syria. It would have extended from Azaz in the east to Jarablus in the west and as far south as Al-Bab. The width of the zone would have been about 68 miles and would have extended around 40 miles deep into Syria, right on the doorstep of Aleppo. That buffer zone was actually created with Turkey's Operation Euphrates Shield, and it has functioned as the last open NATO-protected supply line for ISIS and its allies to enter Syria from Turkey. That comes from the article, Trump Expected to Sign Orders for Safe Zone in Syria, reports, by Brandon Turbeville, post January 26th, originally appearing at Activist Post. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
On this week's episode of the Global Research News Hour, I'm going to be talking with Rodrigue Tremblay. Dr. Tremblay is a PhD economist. He graduated from Stanford University. He is since now the emeritus professor at the University of Montreal. And Dr. Tremblay has written a number of articles about world political economy. You can find many of them on globalresearch.ca, as well as his own blog, The New American Empire. I believe it's .blogspot.com, but you can just search The New American Empire. He's the author of two books. His most recent is The Code for Global Ethics, 10 Humanist Principles, as well as The New American Empire. I want to welcome you to the show, Dr. Tremblay.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Hamlin.
Okay, so certainly in the news lately, in the world political stage, is the election of Donald J. Trump to the U.S. presidency. We've covered this a number of times on the Global Research News Hour, but we definitely want to talk to you this time about some of the economic dimensions of the Trump presidency and where what we can expect in the future. If we could just begin, I understand that the conversation these days about Trump is very charged. There's a lot of ideology out there. It seems like a lot of people are very pro-Trump or anti-Trump. Can we just kind of lay our cards on the table and kind of show where you kind of fit in terms of your overall impression of the Trump administration before we get into some of the details?
Well, as the Chinese say, we are living in interesting times. And I think the election of Mr. Trump last November will have tremendous consequences, not only for the United States, but I think for the world, because Mr. Trump has a program to reverse what has been the U.S. policy, the American policy, since 1945. So reversing a course of action that has lasted for 70 years is bound to have consequences and create turbulence. Therefore, this is a phenomenon. Mr. Trump is a political, is a businessman, of course, who became a politician. And this is a phenomenon that many political scientists and journalists and analysts will study in the years to come, because as we have seen during the first year, the first week of his administration, he has set up in motion a lot of changes through decrees. And this will unfold in the coming weeks, months, and years to come.
Okay, so you mentioned that over the last 70 years, there's been something of a consensus in terms of how America will lead the world economy and the world political situation. And you talked about this abrupt change. Let's unpack that a little bit and look at the different dimensions of the change. So I've read that you've talked about one issue we could think about is trade integration. So over the last 70 years, we have something like globalization, the expansion of multilateral trade agreements, the integration of regional and then supranational economies. And it looks like Trump is at least talking about reversing some of that. Could you speak to some of the economic issues there and what you see going forward?
Well, yes. I think President Donald Trump, it's a throwback of 100 years back. In other words, we are going back to colon in the 1920s when we had Republican administration that were very much isolationist and protectionist. It's not only that we go back to 1945. I think we go back even before 1945 as far as American vision of the world. So what happened during the election, during the election, the 2016 election, people tend to confound the messenger, who is Mr. Trump, and the message. And 70 million Americans voted for the message, even if many of them didn't like very much Mr. Trump himself, being somewhat obnoxious and bullying and throwing attacks right and left. But the message may have been left lost to many people. As you mentioned, and as I raised the issue, since 1945, through the GATT and through the WTO, the World Trade Organization, with the creation of the United Nations, the United States government was a leader of expanding a worldview of affairs. And the belief was that countries should not be going for their own narrow interests, but look to the general interest in order to keep peace in the world. And that's why all these institutions, the IMF, the World WTO, and all these other organizations were created. Unfortunately, as far as from an economic point of view, there was a flaw in that approach. And that flaw appears especially in the last 25 years. Before the last 25 years, the emphasis was based on creating more trade between nations in order to have more specializations, better productivity, and raise the standard of living of every country. But about 25 years ago, the idea became that corporations, manufacturers, should be able to move from one country freely. So from free trade, we added the free movement of corporations. And this is something which is not economically sound in the sense that labor forces in every country are immobile as far as geography is concerned. People cannot move from one country if they are unemployed to get employment in another country. But when corporations move their capital and their technology to other countries in order to profit from low wages and better conditions of production, that left behind, this has two main effects. Probably first, it leaves behind unemployed peoples or underemployed peoples in the country from where they come from. And the second thing also, it reduces the benefits from free trade. Free trade is supposed to be based on comparative economic advantages of each country, specializing in different industries. But when you move your corporations and your technology to another country, then you lose some of your comparative advantages. And many people resent that. And I believe that even if people didn't articulate these things during the last elections, many people, the 70 million people who voted for Mr. Trump, even though 73 million voted for Mrs. Clinton, they felt that the U.S. has been a bit too generous in moving its corporations abroad, its technology, and the benefits of many under-educated Americans have been zero or sometimes negative, and that's the reason why they voted for Mr. Trump, even though maybe they didn't like his approach, they like his message.
Mm-hmm. So you do see an internal logic, a rational argument to be made for some sort of backing up from the type of globalization that we've had. But if I understand, you also have a concern about what that could mean for the global economy. We've had retreats from globalization before, earlier on in the 20th century and at various points in the 19th century. And one of the advantages of multilateral free trade is that reduces the inclination to use trade policy as a political tool. And it keeps you out of trade wars and things that really don't help your economy. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Oh, yes. As I mentioned in my article, What to Expect from the Trump Administration, I raised 10 issues that I fear Mr. Trump, his administration may go too far, too fast, and throw the baby of free trade with the bad water of offshore sourcing of jobs by large corporations. That's what I'm afraid with Mr. Trump, is that he may confuse the two. Free trade is good for every nation if it is done within the rules, but the movement of international corporations and the movement of technology may benefit the world in total, but may hurt the country that loses its competitive advantages.
Right.
And therefore, a debate should be carried in the U.S., and I will hope that the American economists, especially from universities, will enter into that debate, because there seems to be a confusion in the political debate in the U.S., between free trade and free movement of international corporations. And that will be very negative if free trade were cast aside and create a lot of dislocation in many economies, and everybody will lose, including the United States, because if the United States has been benefiting tremendously from free trade, probably the country that has benefited the most since 1945. And therefore, as I said in my article, I ask Mr. Trump to be careful in destroying three-quarter of a century of policy in a few days or in a few weeks, because the world doesn't function like that. Companies don't function like that. And that would be very detrimental for the United States, would be detrimental for the world economy, and for the Mexican and the Canadian economy in particular. North America can be destabilized.
Okay, we only have so much time, so let's switch gears and talk about income inequality. The rise of Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side really brought to light some of the real political force of income inequality. We have the Occupy movement talking about the 1%, and there really is a concern out there that today income inequality is rising and this is not sustainable and is at odds with democracy. Do you think that the Trump economic agenda overall should increase or reduce income inequality, and why?
Well, that's the big question, of course, because you are right. The rise in inequality, income and wealth inequality, is a throwback to the 1920s and the 1930s. And this is well documented. And the danger is that if Mr. Trump and his administration push forward the wrong policies, they may increase inequality rather than decrease it. In other words, make the rich richer and the poor poorer. That will be a destruction in a sense of what people are expecting, because during the election in 2016, people voted for the message of Mr. Trump, that he wanted to improve things economically for the very people that Mrs. Clinton called the deplorable, the poorly educated Americans. He wanted to stop outsourcing of American jobs abroad by American corporations. And he, Mr. Trump, captured the resentments and the frustrations, economic and social, of many discontent Americans about the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and about, of course, also the political gridlock in Washington, D.C., where very little can be done. But if he goes too far and dislocate the large American corporations, their productivity will go down, and they won't be able to bring back all the jobs that have been established in China or in Mexico. There will be a lot of frictions. We may end up into having trade wars like in the 1930s, where we had the Smoot-Hawley Act in the United States passed in the 1930s, which raised a large border, high border tax on imported goods. My advice to Mr. Trump is that don't confuse things. Don't confuse things. Don't touch free trade. But you may tax American corporations that leave $2 or $3 trillions of dollars in tax havens, bring that money back to the U.S. for investments, invest in new technology and in new plants. That's very good. But don't confuse things. And I think there's a level of confusion in both Mr. Trump's mind and in his in some of his advisors that I've heard on radio or TV. And that's my fear, that there's not enough clear view of what should be done to improve things for everybody, including, of course, mainly to begin with American workers and the middle class in the U.S. who has been suffering from the rise in the inequalities over the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot there. I want to follow up on the tax issue. Trump has talked about a couple things. One of them is lowering the corporate tax on profits from 35% to 15%. He's also has ideas for a wide-ranging tax overhaul, which would simplify the tax code and bring down especially marginal rates quite a bit. When you look at that, the Center for Tax Policy Analysis in the U.S. has said that a lot of that would have a regressive effect on income. Do you accept the argument that by that these tax cuts will create jobs and in the long term maybe even be neutral or positive for income equality?
Well, there again, there's always a problem of reaching for something and ending with another result. Of course, it would be very feasible for the Trump administration to tax foreign profits by American corporations differently than domestic profits. If it were done that way, that would be helpful to the U.S. economy. But if they keep lowering taxes, by the way, the real corporate tax in the U.S. is not 35%. This is on the books. But the main, the average corporate tax, real corporate tax, is about 12.5%. Therefore, if they keep lowering corporate taxes lower, and at the same time they want to reduce the deficit, then they will have to touch the entitlement and the social programs that the U.S. government has. Of course, we're talking about the Obamacare, but Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and all that. And then the poor Americans would be, the poorest American would be the most suffering from these lowering of public expenditures for social purposes, and therefore inequalities may increase. So it's not a sure thing that you know, just by lowering taxes for corporations that you will get the result. It has to be a more precise approach of taxes. And of course, if they raise the border tax on all imports, then that will hurt everybody.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the market has voted itself on the Trump when you have a noticeable increase in market valuations on the stock market. There's reports that small business confidence has dramatically increased since the election of Trump. What do you think is behind the popular perception, at least in the business community, that Trump will be good for business?
Well, there are three main reasons. The first, of course, if you announce that you're going to lower corporate taxes, that means that after-tax profits for corporations will be larger, higher, and therefore their market valuation is higher. That's a reason. The second reason, the Trump administration wants to abolish many regulations that small companies, small corporations like to be abolished, and therefore that's another plus. And of course, it wants to set forward $1 trillion over 10 years of infrastructure expenditures that will create jobs for small and medium-sized companies. So this is understandable. Although I will say that the stock market now is in the bubble and in the last phase of that bubble. So in the next 2 years, we'll expect a big reversal of the stock market when the Fed keeps increasing interest rates and the Trump policies become more visible in its effects, in its negative effects, then the stock market may tank.
Mm-hmm. In the U.S., the health sector is such a big part of the economy, it's hard to have a discussion about the U.S. economy without talking about health care. Of course, Trump has promised to repeal and replace Obamacare. He's basically said the system doesn't work. More recently, he's talked about renegotiating prices with drug companies and basically just taking a lot of actions that he thinks will benefit the sector in alignment with a free market orientation. How do you see things on the healthcare side in terms of the Trump agenda and the economy?
Well, that's a big question that nobody knows, because the Trump administration hasn't proposed a detailed replacement for the Obamacare. Mind you, the Obamacare was a Republican idea. It came from Mr. Romney's when he was governor of Massachusetts. And the Obama administration would have preferred to have a Canadian approach of a single-payer approach to health care. So this is something which is left in the... it has to be made more precise in the weeks and months ahead, because there's confusion now. There are many plans which have been advanced to replace. Most of them are going to the states, but some states are poorer than others in the U.S., like in any country, and more to the private sector. My feeling is that this will be very difficult to square the circle with that approach. And some people, you know, there are 20 million Americans who had no health coverage before the Obamacare. Some of them may be left aside and be the victim of that program.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
The genius of Mr. Trump's approach was to make a coalition between the Bible Belt supporters and the Rust Belt supporters. And this creates a tremendous coalition in the sense that he ended up winning most of the Midwest American states, and he ended up winning Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, the Rust Belt states, while the Democrats were left with the western coast, California, Oregon, and the east coast, New York, and so on. And now we see that Mr. Trump is very aware of that coalition. He is paying his political debt. Of course, he got a lot, when he made a speech in front of the APEC conference on March 21st, American-Israel Political Action Committee, he got a lot of donors after that speech, and that was very helpful to his campaign. And from the Bible Belt, he's paying his debts now. He's trying to make abortion more difficult to obtain. And he promised to pack the U.S. Supreme Court with pro-life judges, the like of Judge and late Judge Antonin Scalia. And to the Rust Belt, of course, he proposed protectionism to the repatriation of jobs, which have been outsourced to low-labor countries by American corporations, and to renegotiate the international trade and investment agreements. And to those who are afraid of mass immigration and terrorism, of course, he wants to close the borders, made them tighter against illegal immigration, built a wall against Mexico and all that. So people are maybe underestimated the political ability of Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump is not a stupid politician. He is very acute politician who knows how to build the coalition much more than Mrs. Clinton was. Mrs. Clinton proposed some sort of a status quo, more a third term for Mr. Obama. But Mr. Trump went on the offensive and created that tremendous coalition. And that coalition may not be reduced in the years ahead, as many people think. It may expand, as other experiences in Europe of that type of populist politics show. Therefore, we are at the beginning of a process, political process in the U.S., and not at the end.
Okay, you mentioned a number of different types of social forces that supported the election of Trump. What do you think about the old dictum from Bill Clinton that it's the economy, stupid? He said this basically in response to George Bush saying that the real issue that people care about, we can talk about a lot of different social issues, but when it comes down to it, it's do people have a job? Are they making a living wage? Do you think that was of primary importance in this election?
I'm 100% in agreement with that statement. And I think former President Bill Clinton told his wife that she should have talked more about the economy, because people vote their wallet. And if they are unemployed or they have trouble paying their rent and all that, then no matter if the guy is has a bad reputation, but if somebody comes and says, I'm going to help you, they tend to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple as that. As a matter of fact, Professor Lickerman from the University of Washington had a program that had predicted the election for the last, since 1980s, and it predicted the election of Mr. Trump when all the polls were showing that Mrs. Clinton would be elected. And the main reason is because people wanted change to improve their social condition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way most people think when they are in that situation. Of course, people who have no problems can vote their ideology. But people who face economic problems vote their wallet.
Okay, I wanted to actually take a step back and talk about an issue that you just raised in your previous comments, and that was on immigration. Traditionally, you can think immigration comes down to, on the one hand, you're bringing in new talents to the economy, you're diversifying the labor pool, and so you can think of possible advantages of immigration. But on the other hand, there's a concern that if you already have unemployment, then further immigration will just further depress wages and hurt the economy. Trump has talked about certainly ending illegal immigration. Perhaps he's more neutral on legal immigration. How do you think the Trump immigration policy will interface with the economy?
Mr. Trump is on the right track when he talks about immigration and the economy, even if it's not very well articulated. If you are in a free trade environment where you can import labor-intensive goods and export capital and technology-intensive goods in exchange, you don't need as many immigrants as in the past. In the past, when you had protectionism, you had the textile industries, labor-intensive industries, then you could have a lot of immigration. But when you can import labor-intensive goods, you need less immigration. And if you don't do that, if you have a mass immigration policy, as we have in Canada and the U.S., that leaves the uneducated part of your population aside, because they have to compete with low-wage laborers coming from abroad, and their standard of living decline. And these people are going to vote against immigration for sure. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the U.S., of course, they have illegal immigration. They have more than 10 million illegal immigrants from Mexico and from South America. Therefore, there's a real problem there. And the Democrats refuse to talk about that real problem. They stick to their ideology instead of talking about the real problems. At least in the case of Mr. Trump, and I don't want to defend him because I'm afraid of many of his policies, but at least he talked about the problems that the people were facing, mm-hmm. While other politicians talk about ideology and vision of the world that they had, a new world order or whatever. Therefore, the question of immigration is not only a question of a big topic in the U.S., it's a big topic in Canada, and it's a huge topic in Europe. If the European Union disintegrates, it would be because of that of immigration policy by Bruxelles.
That's it for this episode of the Global Research News Hour. You are listening to Dr. Rodrigue Tremblay. He is a PhD economist, educated at Stanford, and current professor emeritus at the University of Montreal. You can check out his most latest article on globalresearch.ca, What to Expect from the Trump Administration, a Protectionist and Pro-Corporate American Government. My name is Colin Hanlon. Thank you for listening to the show.
Objectionable as President Trump and his policies may be, this program has been trying to ascertain what the deep state or power behind the throne is up to. Why was Trump allowed to prevail over Clinton in what is recognized as a rigged system? The deep state seems to be divided over Trump, and we're looking to determine if last week's announcements lead us any closer to learning what the overall game plan is. Meanwhile, Trump has been getting into high-profile fights with the Central Intelligence Agency. Is Trump vulnerable to some sort of overthrow? And if so, how and when would that take place? To discuss these issues, I thought I would bring back Stephen Lenman back to the program. He's an award-winning investigative journalist and blogger. He is the host of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network and a frequent contributor to Global Research. Stephen Lenman, it's good to have you back on the show.
Oh, Michael, thank you very much. It's good to be back on with you.
Could you, I know you just recently, as we're having this conversation, you just posted a new essay, basically. It's called Trump's Disturbing First Week in Office. Would you care to just give us a quick review of the last 7 days, you know, from the inauguration to the fights with the CIA and delays over the Pompeo nomination, the executive orders? What stands out for you about what we can expect from Trump and his agenda?
What I covered in my article, Michael, I didn't go back to the post-election immediately after November 8th. I just covered his first week in office, and I began saying that he responsibly pulled out of the TPP, the trade deal, just a terrible trade deal. And that was a very key issue that he raised throughout his campaign, the fact that America's jobs are being offshored to cheap labor countries. He wants to bring jobs back. I don't know that he'll be able to do that, but if he can figure out a way to get companies to create more jobs in America instead of sending them overseas, that's marvelous. But aside from that, it's been all downhill. I mean, you mentioned the various issues. There have been others. Another one, brand new, I believe, as of yesterday, wanting to oppose a 20% import tax on Mexican products and likely on China as well, what the percentage would be. Who knows? It could be 20%. It could be 10%. It could be any percentage. If he's got this idea on Mexico to pay for his ill-conceived Great Wall, as I call it, also to get more jobs staying in America, he believes that NAFTA is a terrible deal, and it is. There was a terrible fight in the Congress, I remember very well, and it passed by a very, very close vote. It never should have passed at all. It's a disgraceful trade deal. It's destroyed, I believe, over a million U.S. jobs. So the touted as a jobs creator, it's been a jobs destroyer. So Trump is on the right track wanting to get rid of things like this. He talks about renegotiating it. What he should do is trash it all together and just start all over again, having not free trade between America and Mexico and Canada and all other countries, but fair trade. And America certainly does not have fair trade now. So much more, Michael, I'll let you jump back in.
Okay. Well, I am curious then, I mentioned also there are the fights with the CIA, these very, and now the delays over his nominee for CIA director Pompeo. Where do you think that's leading? Is that just a big show, or is there some fundamental beef that the CIA or some faction of the CIA has with Trump? What, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, of course, the CIA was involved with I think the FBI got dragged along, maybe reluctantly. But CIA, FBI, NSA, Department of Homeland Security, DHS, conspired to come up with this cockamamie idea that Russia interfered in America's election. And, of course, Russia had nothing to do with hacking anything or doing anything interfering with America's election. So Trump has and the idea being to delegitimize Trump, maybe undermine his agenda, whatever it turns out to be as it unfolds. And I mean, he certainly has a great deal of right to be angry about this. But when he went to CIA headquarters, I guess it was a bit of a peace offering. And I was amazed to learn that he only addressed about 300 or 400 people. He didn't have a room or whatever facility set up big enough to hold the numbers who wanted to see him. Apparently, as many as 1,000 wanted to hear what he had to say, so only a few hundred got in. But at the end of his talk, Michael, he got a 5-minute standing ovation. Can you imagine that? So, I mean, I guess the lower-level people at CIA support him. Maybe not surprising, but they're not the ones who make the decisions. Others make the decisions. Trump has his own man at CIA, Pompeo, and Mike Pompeo, and John Brennan is out. Trump came down very hard on John Brennan. John Brennan came down very hard on Trump. So at least he has his own man in power there. We'll have to see what happens. I mean, if Trump goes along with the system, part of the establishment and so on, at least for the most part, he'll probably get along very well with the CIA. But if he diverges too much, he could be in very big trouble. Either the CIA, especially, Michael, isn't impeachment. It's taking out anybody by much more sinister means.
Mm-hmm.
But he could be impeached by the Congress and removed. But a couple of presidents impeached. Nobody's ever been removed by impeachment. Trump could end up being the first one.
Yeah. There were a lot of questions circulating. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was rather surprised that Trump ended up winning the election. Not to say that I was a big Hillary supporter, but it seemed clear that a significant chunk of the ruling establishment including obviously much of the mainstream media, were backing Clinton. And I was expecting Clinton to emerge by fair means or foul, because we know elections are often rigged. And I'm wondering if we do you have a better understanding now of what happened? I mean, was there some sort of a mid-course correction, as you point out in one of your articles, that Hillary was damaged goods and they changed on the fly to support Trump? Was there some sort of a deal that was cut? Do you have any better insights now on exactly why Trump is commander-in-chief and not Hillary?
Well, probably the answer will come out long after I'm dead and gone, Michael.
Me too, probably.
When declassified stuff becomes unclassified, and we all know, I think there's no question that Hillary thought absolutely for certain she would be the next president. And in a couple of my articles, I made comments like, get used to hearing Madam President. And you remember what Newsweek did, came out with a preliminary cover, Madam President, on it. It reminded me of the Chicago Tribune in 1948 saying, Dewey wins.
Yeah.
And Truman saying I quoted him saying, ain't the way I heard it. A terrific quote. We don't know. I suspect the things might have come together late in the game, because I can't imagine Hillary wasn't piped in on what the devil is going on. I mean, her husband, an ex-president, she certainly the favorite, the media darling, to say the least. And she had to have some idea about what the heck was going on. It could have been something that came together very, very late in the game, Michael. And she rented a ballroom. I don't forget the whole hotel she was in, a facility she was in, that I believe had a glass ceiling to represent her breaking it, and of course with fireworks and everything else ready to go as soon as her election was announced, and it never happened. So it could have been this all came together very late in the game, and the only thing I can imagine is that the powers that be did think that she was too tainted, and they decided to go with Trump, wanting to control him enough. And if they couldn't, then get rid of him and go with Pence.
There's something I picked up. It was one of a commentary by Larry Chin, and who was talk, which was posted on the Global Research site, and it mentioned these emails that from the private server, and that were they had a collection of them on the Anthony Weiner site, and what he mentioned was that there may have been some, you know, between that and the Clinton Foundation activities, there may have been information that may have been damaging to deep state, black op, clandestine operations that really compromised, a deep operation that even more important than who becomes president, and so some action needed to be taking place to counter, or at some level she was a threat to some certain entrenched interests, and that's why they went with Trump, and maybe cut a deal along the way, and I don't know if maybe Mike Pence was part of that deal, because it seems as if he is. He would be acceptable to the deep state, even if Trump's, who's given to certain sorts of idiosyncratic behavior is maybe potentially problematic. So, but I tend to see Mike Pence as insurance, in the event that Trump steps out of line.
Oh, I agree with everything you said, and the fact also that Hillary used her home server. And I mean, this stuff with a Democrat Party insiders not too happy with her for stealing the nomination from Bernie Sanders. I think this is the reason the leaks, maybe the original reason for the stuff leaking in the first place. Certainly wasn't hacked by Russia, but it was leaked by one or more party insiders. And there's a whole lot more stuff that hasn't come out. The 650,000 emails that the FBI managed to review in 24 hours.
Yeah.
Or 48 or 72 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, heaven only knows what stuff was in that. I mean, there could be some stuff, and it could be floating around, and maybe there could be some more leaks exposing more stuff. I think the powers that be may be very concerned about the Hillary information that just might at some point become public. I really do believe that she became damaged goods. There was just so much floating around. Even the major media couldn't hide everything rotten about her. I mean, the worst stuff they kept under wraps, but certainly a lot of it came out, and it probably came down to, let's go with Trump Pence, and we got Pence, who certainly, and he had to be in on this too. We've got Pence as a good backup, and we'll go with him if we have to. And it's only 7 days into Trump's administration, Michael, so it's really too early to judge him. I'm not at all happy with what's gone on so far. And, I mean, it really is an indication of what's likely to come. But we got to give him more time and see what happens. We'll see. I'm not optimistic. That I will say absolutely.
Is there anything that's come out in the last week that's that caught you off guard? You know, for better or for worse, that you didn't see coming.
I'm surprised he's done so much so fast. I know enough about U.S. history and U.S. politics never to get too optimistic about a new administration. The only president I ever respected was Jack Kennedy. And he didn't come in as a peacemaker. He transformed himself in office. And that's the reason they got rid of him. It wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. CIA just bumped him off to get rid of him. And Lyndon Johnson was their man. And there were rumors that George H.W. Bush was involved. And even talk of Nixon being involved. My memory's a little foggy on that. It's been so long since I read some stuff on it. But he had to go, and that was a lesson for all future presidents. You don't mess with the system, because if you do, you may not be around very long. It's so easy to get rid of everybody. The president I think of as a front man for the power system, and he or she, it's always been a he, one day it'll be a she, will either go along with that system or be in very big trouble, unless somewhere way down the road something happens, a revolution or something in America, and the system changes. But it's an entire history, 240-odd years or so. It's always been the same thing. Never been anything different. There's no democracy in America. People who think that America is a democracy are living in a dream world. There simply isn't any. We have a one-party state with two right wings. There used to be a little differentiation between the wings way back, but at least since the neoliberal 90s, that all ended. So we really have, you could call them Republicrats or reverse the terminology, and it's one party, and they take turns who puts their people into power. But this is the way the country is run. The people have no say about anything, and I just can't see anything happening ahead that's going to be good for the ordinary people of the country. More neoliberal harshness, more maybe the war's continuing. No doubt the war's continuing, whether it's the same scenario as under Obama, Bush, Cheney, the Clintons, I don't know. But I don't see anything changing very, very much. I think Trump will go along with most of it. But we'll see. He'll probably get his way on some things. But on the stuff that the deep state does not want any divergence from, he'll either play ball or he won't be around very long, Michael.
Mm. Now, Stephen, do you see anything in the way Trump has conducted himself? I mean, is this guy what he appears to be, a buffoon, or is there anything that he's doing or saying which is, you know, with the hidden dog whistle-ish intent of sending a message to those powers that be, either to defend himself or some other mechanism like that? Because I assume he knows that he is under threat if he's, as you say, if he doesn't play ball. I mean, is he determined to defy those entities, and does he have the ability to defend himself or otherwise? Do you see him sending these sorts of meta messages out there that the rest of us are maybe oblivious to and misinterpreting?
Well, of course, he can't he can't defy the system and win the game, Michael. There's no question about that. But he's said things and done things as president. I, in my lifetime, never heard or saw before. I mean, he's attacked the major media. Who ever heard of a president attacking the major media? He's come down hard. Yeah. We call him a bunch of liars and stuff like that.
But is that deliberate, is there some sort of is there a method to his madness, or is this just him popping off because he's insane?
Well, I mean, the media certainly went after him, and they're still going after him. He made that lying comment in his talk at CIA headquarters. I think the people there appreciated it. I think he got a round of applause when he said that. And he went after the previous CIA head, John Brennan, really attacked him savagely. I think the last president who did that was Jack Kennedy. I don't know if he named the CIA director, but he said he wanted to tear the agency into 1,000 pieces, get rid of the agency. He made a mistake. He thought he might go after them in his second term, and there never was a second term. But Trump may be settling down. He's got his own man at CIA. He's made some very tough comments. I'll watch what he says ahead. If he keeps up this diatribe against the way America is run, the establishment and so on, then he certainly will be different straight down the road. It could be a lot of the stuff that he's done has been rhetoric, and he'll simply get back on track and go along with the system. But again, it's so early in the game, Michael, we don't know.
Well, I hear what you're saying there, but I can't resist asking one more question. Is there a specific policy? I mean, we know with Kennedy, the general feeling is that it was around Cuba and backing away from moving away from that militaristic stance that seemed to be the death knell for his administration and his life. Where do you anticipate Trump might cross the line and effectively be replaced, either through impeachment or some other means?
Oh, that's easy. That's easy. If he makes rapprochement with Vladimir Putin, and they both cooperate with each other, and maybe even silently they become buddies. Silent buddies. I mean, if he gets along with Putin and they cooperate with each other, especially if he tries getting rid of the sanctions, that could be the coup de grace for him. He could be a goner if he does that. I mean, he's got. I would imagine 100% of, maybe not 100%, but close to 100% of the Congress against doing something like that. He's on track being anti-China, being rough on China, being rough on Iran. But if he gets along with Putin and they cooperate with each other, and we see nice pleasantries exchanged between the two of them, and we see the cooperation in what is happening, like Trump's as America's commander in chief stops intervening militarily against other countries and concentrates only on combating terrorism with Russia and anybody else. That would definitely go against the system, and that could be the end of the line for him.
Okay. Well, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen. As always, we appreciate your analysis and your contributions to our program and the site.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael. There's so much going on. There'll be so much more to talk about ahead.
Absolutely. I've been speaking with Stephen Lendman, an award-winning investigative journalist and the host of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Be sure to check out his blog, sjlendman.blogspot.ca, as well as his regular contributions to the Global Research website.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to this week's guest contributor, Colin Hamlin. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.